You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk Nation Radio, millions of Americans lose their minds over unproven accusations against Russia, and civil liberties groups, the ACLU and CARE, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the Council on American-Islamic Relations, push the absurd idea that the 2003 until now war on Iraq has been fought to protect the U.S. Bill of Rights. First, allegations against Russia are less credible every day. The U.S. government has now generated numerous news stories and released multiple reports aimed at persuading us that Vladimir Putin is to blame for Donald Trump becoming president. U.S. media has dutifully informed us that the case has been made. What has been made is the case for writing your own news coverage. The reports from the so-called intelligence community are no lengthier than the New York Times and Washington Post articles about them. Why not just read the reports and cut out the middle person? The New York Times calls the latest report, quote, damning and surprisingly detailed, before later admitting in the same so-called news article that the report, quote, contained no information about how the agencies had collected their data or had come to their conclusions, end quote. A quick glance at the report itself would have made clear to you that it did not pretend to present a shred of evidence that Russia hacked emails or served as a source for WikiLeaks. Yet Congresswoman Barbara Lee declared the evidence in this evidence-free report overwhelming. What should progressives believe? The best congresswoman we've got, or our own lying eyes? Supposedly the evidence has been made public and is overwhelming, but try to find it and you'll come up dry. Ask why, and you'll be told that, of course, the evidence cannot be made public as that would risk revealing how the U.S. government came upon the information. Yet, that same government feeds the U.S. media with the story that it intercepted communications of top Russian officials just after the U.S. election celebrating Trump's victory. Did that story not run that risk? The U.S. government feeds the U.S. media, specifically the so-called free press of the Washington Post, whose owner makes more money from the CIA than from the Washington Post, that Russia has hacked Vermont's electrical supply. And because this was a claim that could be checked by an independent party, namely Vermont's electrical supply, the secret methods of the CIA quickly turned out to be these. They had simply made the thing up. If you read the reports that the U.S. government releases and understand that the term assess is a synonym for to claim without evidence, it will very quickly become clear that reports on Russians' motives for the alleged crimes, as well as for their non-criminal public actions, such as running a television network, are purely guesses. It also becomes clear that the U.S. government is not even claiming to have any evidence that Russia was a source for WikiLeaks. And with a bit of help, it should become evident to anyone that the U.S. government is not claiming to have any actual evidence of the Russian government hacking Democratic emails. Even the NSA will commit only to, quote, moderate confidence in what millions of Democrats will now stake their lives and potentially everybody else's on. Former top NSA expert on this stuff, William Binney, swears the claims are utter nonsense. IP addresses produced as supposed evidence turn out in many cases to have nothing to do with Russia at all, much less the Russian government. When the 17 intelligence organizations put their collective multi-billion-dollar brains together and report on anything that's publicly available, they tend to get it wrong. The facts about Russia's television network in this latest so-called report misidentify personnel, describe old programs as new ones, and screw up dates by failing to recognize that in some parts of the world, people list the day before the month. Yet, we are supposed to believe that anything they say about topics not publicly available must be true, despite having proved false over and over again for decades. WikiLeaks, which never claimed Iraq had WMDs, never alleged Gaddafi was about to commit a massacre, never sent missiles from drones into a single wedding or hospital, never concocted tales of babies taken from incubators, never screwed up its claims regarding chemical weapons attacks or the shooting down of airplanes, and in fact has never, as far as we know, tried to lie it to us at all, says Russia was not its source. Julian Assange clearly does not think Russia used someone else to pass information to him. He could be wrong. But Craig Murray, a diplomat with a stellar reputation for honesty, claims to know at least one source and to place them in either the NSA or the Democratic Party. Of course, having a plausible alternative account is not necessary to recognize that the U.S. government has no evidence to support its account. But the fact is that Murray's and numerous other scenarios are perfectly plausible. One ought to await evidence before declaring one of them fact. But we can go ahead and declare the CIA's story less and less likely with each passing day. NSA whistleblowers like Binney believe that if this story were true, the NSA would have evidence of it. It is safe to assume that if the NSA had evidence of it, some outline of that evidence would have been made public by now, rather than all the fluff, nonsense, and incompetent false attributions of IP addresses to Russia, etc. As each new perfumed pig of a report is released in Friday evening news dumps, we can advance ever closer to declaring that while the Russian government has indeed done far worse things, it did not do this. In fact, the latest report doesn't just produce no evidence of hacking and providing to WikiLeaks, it also tries to change the subject to things Russia openly and publicly did that nobody disputes, but that the so-called intelligence agencies still managed to screw up all the details on. I once, no kidding, invited a former CIA agent to speak at an event on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and the guy was late because he was unable to find it. The accusations against Russia in the latest overwhelming report include favoring proposals to work with Russia over proposals to build hostility, shocking, and running a television network that many people in the United States choose to watch, the outrage, how capitalistic. And in the the television network is accused of cheering for Trump's election. As if the British media wouldn't have cheered for Clinton's. As if the U.S. media doesn't cheer for election winners abroad all the time. This network, RT, is also accused of covering third-party candidates, fracking, Occupy, vote suppression, flaws in the U.S. election system, and other forbidden topics. Well, why do you think people watch it? If the U.S. media gave good time to third-party candidates, would people have to turn elsewhere to learn about them? If the U.S. media could be trusted not to claim a U.S. government report was damning in the same article that would later admit it was devoid of evidence, would people in the U.S. search for alternative sources of information? If the U.S. media allowed honest reporting on Occupy or fracking, if it opened itself up to a wide range of points of view and debate, if it allowed serious criticism of U.S. government policies supported by both big parties, would people despise it the way they do? Would people cheer when a fascist buffoon like Trump denounces the media? Isn't the U.S. media's awfulness, combined with the incredible free airtime it gave Trump, a fair target of blame for his becoming president? When I go on RT and suggest that the United States should end all its wars, and that Russia should too, I'm invited back on. The last U.S. network to have me on was MSNBC, and I opposed U.S. war-making and was never heard from again. Perhaps most people watching U.S. media don't quite realize that there are no anti-war voices allowed, no voices that actually want to abolish war. Yet most people feel there is something missing on this and most topics. There's lots of supposed debate on U.S. media, yet a dim or glaring awareness among viewers and readers that the debate is severely limited. Here is an example close to hand. Whoever revealed to the U.S. public additional evidence that the Democratic Party had slanted its primary against Bernie Sanders did us all a favor. Those who still wanted to vote for Hillary Clinton, which was clearly most, if not all, the people who did before, could still do so. But anyone who approved of Hillary Clinton's disastrous decades-long record and yet objected to the unfair primary could choose not to vote for her. An informed public is a more democratic one, not less. Whoever informed us aided our democracy. They didn't damage it. And whoever informed us was not themselves responsible for rigging the primary against Sanders. That was the Democratic Party. But this point of view is neither permitted in the U.S. media nor consciously missed, because the topic has been focused on who done it, rather than what did they do. A second example is this. Those in the U.S. government pushing for greater cold, if not hot, war with Russia, with increased desperation during these next 2 weeks, will be benefiting weapons profiteers and perhaps news profiteers. But just about nobody else, while risking incredible death and destruction. If I were a so-called intelligence agency, I would assess with high confidence that corruption was afoot, and I'd get 16 friends to join me in calling that assessment a report if it helped you take it seriously. These fantasies about Russia could be dooming opposition to Donald Trump. To many Democrats for whom killing a million people in Iraq just didn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense, and who considered Obama's bombing of eight nations and the creation of the drone murder program to be praiseworthy, Trump will be impeachable on day one. Indeed, Trump should be impeached on day one, but the same Democrats who found the one nominee who could lose to Trump will find the one argument for impeachment that can explode in their own faces. Here's a, quote, progressive Democrat. Quote, in his dalliance with Vladimir Putin, Trump's actions are skirting treason. By undermining further investigation or sanctions against the Russian manipulation of the 2016 election, Trump, as president, would be giving aid and comfort to Russian interference with American democracy. End quote. There's a bit of a nod there in the word investigations to the lack of any evidence that Russia manipulated any U.S. election. Yet that manipulation is stated as fact, and a failure to support further sanctions as punishment for it becomes aid and comfort. What level of punishment exactly constitutes the absence of aid and comfort? And how does that level of punishment compare with the level likely to produce war or nuclear holocaust? Who knows? Failure to sufficiently punish a foreign government, even for an actual proven offense, has never been a high crime and misdemeanor, until this column I quoted from, which was by Robert Kuttner. The United States is, in fact, bound by the Hague Convention of 1899, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, and the United Nations Charter, to take any such dispute to arbitration and to settle it by pacific means. But that would require producing some evidence rather than mere allegations. Lawless, quote-unquote, punishment is much easier. But further evidence can emerge to counter the claim. The lack of evidence for the claim can weigh ever more heavily on public opinion, and the dangers of creating further hostility with Russia can enter the consciousness of additional people. Meanwhile, we have a man planning to be president later this month whose business dealings clearly violate the U.S. Constitution in terms of not only foreign but also domestic corruption. That's a perfectly overwhelming case for impeachment and removal from office that doesn't require opposing a single incident of mass murder or offending a single Pentagon contractor. Beyond that, Trump is becoming president after Election Day intimidation, after the partisan-based removal of voters from the rolls, and opposition to attempting to count paper ballots where they existed. He's arriving with the stated policies of unconstitutionally discriminating against Muslims, murdering families, stealing oil, torturing, and proliferating nuclear weapons. In other words, Donald Trump will be from day one an impeachable president, and Democrats will have already spent months building their campaign around the one thing that won't work. Imagine what will happen after all their hearings and press conferences, when their supporters find out that they aren't even accusing Vladimir Putin of hacking into election machines, that in fact they are accusing unknown individuals of hacking into Democrats' emails, and that they are then vaguely speculating that those individuals could have been sources for WikiLeaks, thereby informing the U.S. public of what was quite obvious and ought to have been widely reported for the good of the U.S. government, namely that the DNC rigged its primary. By the time the Democrats beat themselves to the floor with this charade, more facts will likely have come out regarding WikiLeaks' actual source or sources, and more hostility will likely have been stirred up with Russia. the war hawks have already got Trump talking up nuclear escalation. Luckily, there is an ace in the hole. There is something else that Democrats will be eager to hold Trump accountable for. And give Trump a month, and he'll likely produce it. I'm referring, of course, to that greatest fear of our beloved founding fathers, the ultimate high crime and misdemeanor, the presidential sex scandal. Turning now to the ACLU and CARE, two significant civil liberties organizations in the United States, who on the same recent day used a spokesman, a Gold Star father, a man whose son had died in the war on Iraq, from here in Charlottesville, Virginia, used him to claim that war on Iraq was for the Bill of Rights. Are you old enough to remember when liberal groups openly admitted that the war on Iraq was illegal and fraudulent based on oil and profit and sadism? Well, can you recall when the proponents of the war claimed it was a defense against non-existent ties to terrorists and non-existent weapons? Even if you've wiped those memories clean, let me assure you, nobody ever claimed that attacking and destroying Iraq was necessary to protect civil liberties in the United States, which have been seriously eroded during the course of that war. Yet, in recent months, the generic defense of murdering large numbers of people far away has taken over as the explanation for the war on Iraq. The ACLU, on a recent Friday, used the voice of my fellow Charlottesvillian, Kizer Khan, to claim that attacking Iraq was done, quote, in defense of our country's ideals. You can see an image of their email on my website at davidswanson.org. And of this one, also on the same Friday, CARE, which I can recall supporting Denis Kucinich for president because he opposed the war, claimed, also through the voice of Khan, that Iraq was destroyed, quote, to continue to have the freedoms guaranteed in the pages of our Constitution. CARE even suggested that participating in such activities as attacking Iraq, which killed over a million people, see warisacrime.org/Iraq for details, is a duty of American Muslims, and presumably everybody else. Is it possible that civil liberties groups do not know that war is the primary source of violations and restrictions on civil liberties? We are often told that wars are fought for, quote, freedom. But when a wealthy nation fights a war against a poor, if often resource-rich, nation halfway around the globe, among the goals is not actually to prevent that poor nation from taking over the wealthy one, after which it might restrict people's rights and liberties. The fears used to build support for the wars don't involve such an incredible scenario at all. Rather, the threat is depicted as one to safety, not liberty. Those people are going to blow us up, not limit our rights in court or restrict our public demonstrations to fenced-in pens where they can't be seen. We're going to have to do those things to ourselves. Sometimes we're told that evil people are going to blow us up because they hate our freedoms. But then that would still mean we were fighting a war for survival, not for freedom, if there were any truth to this absurd propaganda, which there is not. People can be motivated to fight by all kinds of means, including religion, racism, or hatred of a culture, but the underlying motivation for anti-U.S. violence from nations where the U.S. funds and arms dictators or maintains a large troop presence or imposes deadly economic sanctions or bombs houses or occupies towns or buzzes drones overhead is those actions. Many nations equal or surpass the United States in civil liberties without making themselves targets. What happens, predictably and consistently, is just the reverse of wars protecting freedoms. In close proportion to levels of military spending, liberties are restricted in the name of war, even while wars may simultaneously be waged in the name of liberty. We try to resist the erosion of liberties, the warrantless surveillance, the drones in the skies, the lawless imprisonment, the torture, the assassinations, the denial of a lawyer, the denial of access to information on the government, etc. But these are symptoms. The disease is war and the preparation for war. It is the idea of the enemy that allows government secrecy. It is the idea of war that most effectively concentrates government power in fewer hands and expands that power at the expense of the people. Only by restricting, reducing, and eliminating military spending can we restrict, reduce, or eliminate war. And only by restricting, reducing, or eliminating war can we do the same to this erosion of rights and liberties. The nature of war, as fought between valued and devalued people, facilitates the erosion of liberties in another way, in addition to the fear for safety. That is, it allows liberties to first be taken away from devalued people. But the programs developed to accomplish that are later predictably expanded to include valued people as well. First, foreigners are imprisoned, tortured, assassinated, or hunted by drone. Then people in one's own country are targeted as well, accused of having joined the enemy. They may be stripped of their citizenship in the UK version, or their citizenship stripped of all rights or privileges in the US version. But come home to roost, the abuses of wartime will, and there they will remain, even beyond the termination of wartime, should that termination ever arrive. Militarism erodes not just particular rights, but the very basis of self-governance. It privatizes public goods. It corrupts public servants. It creates momentum for war by making people's careers dependent on it. Over a half century ago, U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower warned, quote, "We annually spend on military security more than the net income of all United States corporations. This conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist." End quote. War not only shifts power to the government and the few and away from the people, but it also shifts power to a president or prime minister and away from a legislature or judiciary. James Madison, father of the U.S. Constitution, warned, quote, "Of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded, because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and of morals engendered by both. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare." The Constitution supposes what the history of all governments demonstrates, that the executive is the branch of power most interested in war and most prone to it. It has accordingly, with studied care, vested the question of war in the legislature. End quote. Once upon a time. One way in which war erodes public trust and morals is by its predictable generation of public lies. Makers of war hide every merit in their enemies and every flaw in themselves. They disguise the aim of profit or vengeance or lust for power as the aim of defense or philanthropy. And these lies may last long enough to start a war, but often do not last much beyond that, the truth of the matter tending to be very clearly exposed. Also eroded, of course, is the very idea of the rule of law, replaced with the practice of might makes right. Laws against war and other laws and rules and standards are brushed aside in the madness of war, which sets an example of lawlessness for all to follow. A young man was tortured in Chicago this past week. It wasn't an act of the Chicago police. It was live streamed on Facebook, and the President of the United States declared it a horrific hate crime. The president did not advise looking forward rather than enforcing the law, nor did he hold open the possibility that the crime might have served some higher purpose. In fact, he didn't excuse the crime in any way that might help recommend it for imitation by others. Yet this same president has forbidden the prosecution of U.S. government torturers for the past 8 years and has now seen fit to keep a 4-year-old Senate report on their torture secret for at least 12 years more. Some people in the United States would maintain that environmental and climate policy should be based on facts. Some other people, there's very little overlap between the two groups, would tell you that U.S. policy toward Russia should be based on proven facts. Yet, here we are readily accepting that U.S. torture policy will be based on burying the facts. The primary author of the Senate torture report, Dianne Feinstein, calls it, quote, a total expose of the ineffectiveness of torture. Yet here comes President Trump openly promising to engage in torture because of its effectiveness, morality and legality be damned, and both Obama and Feinstein are content to leave the report hidden. That is to say, Feinstein insists it should be made public now, but she is not herself taking the step of making it public. Yes, although the U.S. Constitution makes the Congress the most powerful branch of government, centuries of imperial empowerment has persuaded pretty much everyone that a president can censor the Senate's reports. But if Feinstein truly believed it mattered, she would find the courage of a whistleblower and take her chances with the Justice Department. The chances of Donald Trump releasing or reading the report seem slim but possible. If Obama really wanted to bury the report for good, he would leak it now and announce that Russians were responsible. Then it would be everyone's patriotic duty not to report on or look at it. Debbie Wasserman who? But our public interest, having paid for the report, not to mention the torture, is in immediate disclosure without shenanigans. Go to rootsaction.org to sign a petition to both President Obama and Senator Feinstein. Not long after this petition was launched, demanding that Obama release the report, he announced that he would protect it from feared destruction by keeping it secret for 12 years or more. A much surer way to protect it from destruction would be to make it public. It's been 4 years since the Senate Intelligence Committee produced this 7,000-page report. It's hard enough for a 7,000-page document to go up against myths, lies, and Hollywood movies, but it's a truly unfair fight when the document is kept secret. Only a 500-page censored summary was released 2 years ago. NPR's David Wellner recently reported on this topic in a manner typical of the U.S. media, saying, President-elect Trump campaigned on bringing back torture, which was outlawed during the Obama administration. In fact, torture was outlawed by, among other laws, the Eighth Amendment, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Convention Against Torture, joined by the U.S. during the Reagan administration, and the anti-torture and war crimes statutes in the U.S. Code since the Clinton administration. Torture was a felony throughout the period of time covered by the torture report. President Obama forbade prosecution, although the Convention Against Torture requires it. The rule of law has suffered. But some measure of truth and reconciliation remains possible if we are allowed to know the truth, or rather if we are allowed to have the truth reconfirmed in an authoritative document guaranteed to be taken seriously. If we are denied the truth about torture, lies will continue to justify it, and it will continue to claim victims, as does every other tool of war. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, it seems clear that for Donald Trump, as for Humpty Dumpty, words mean just what he chooses them to mean, neither more nor less. So if Trump says he's erased his conflicts of interest by letting his kids run his businesses day to day, well, then those conflicts are erased, and it's fake news to say otherwise. The question for the press corps, then, is whether they will keep both feet in reality or allow the perceived requirement to include the Trump camp's spin on things like conflicts to redefine previous understandings beyond recognition. We'll talk about the substance and the coverage of the problem with investigative reporter Russ Choma from Mother Jones. Also on the show, activists with the group Food Not Bombs were arrested recently in Florida for giving food to homeless people in the park. There's sadly nothing new about that, but at a time when more people are looking to get involved in social action, it's good to get versed on the arguments you're likely to hear for why, in this case, helping hungry people be less hungry will put you on the wrong side of the law. We'll hear about food sharing and its restriction from Megan Hustings, director of the National Coalition for the Homeless. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at recent press. As we record the show, Jefferson Sessions seems to be on his way to becoming Attorney General. Many people are angry and frightened that the person in charge of the Justice Department could be a man whose public record demonstrates hostility to the idea of equal rights under the law. In particular, Sessions tried to imprison voting rights advocates working with Martin Luther King on vote fraud charges. He has referred to the Voting Rights Act as intrusive and supported voter suppression. That's why there have been sit-ins and phone banks and multi-group public statements reflecting the large number and wide range of people familiar with Sessions who state that his record, not his accent or personal demeanor, make him unfit for office. In this light, the January 8th New York Times editorial struck me as highlighting painfully the limits of elite media. "What are you hiding, Jeff Sessions?" was the headline, and the thrust of the thing is that Sessions has been insufficiently forthcoming. Quote, "If anyone requires a thorough vetting, it's Mr. Sessions, the Republican senator from Alabama, who trails behind him a toxic cloud of hostility to racial equality, voting rights, women's rights, criminal justice reform, and other issues at the heart of the Justice Department's mandate." Close quote. See, some would say that toxic record constitutes such a vetting. But for corporate media, some questions are forever being raised, even when many another would suggest they'd actually been answered. Indeed, all the while it's criticizing Sessions' lack of disclosure, the Times is making clear that it isn't necessary. Sessions claimed there's no record of many of the interviews he's given. Quote, "but a quick Google search disproves that," close quote. The paper details his rejection for a federal judgeship based on testimony about his racism from former colleagues. Then they state that Sessions himself made no mention of that on a questionnaire that specifically requested the information. He's now saying he personally litigated desegregation cases, which the Times calls a myth that has been debunked. He failed to mention comments to Fox about Trump's bragging about sexual assault, comments the Times provides a link to, and so on. Yet, despite all of this, the editorial's upshot was that, quote, "Mr. Sessions is trying to hide from the American people the things he said and did," close quote. And the answer, quote, "Dianne Feinstein, the committee's ranking Democrat, needs to take the lead in ensuring that Americans know as much as possible about the man who would be the nation's top law enforcement official," close quote. If only there were some other social actor or institution positioned to prevent a politician from hiding his record from the public, who could help ensure Americans know as much as possible about him. Who would that be? Well, not corporate media, presumably, if asking what Jeff Sessions is hiding is as far as they're willing to go with regard to what's in plain sight. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Donald Trump owns a lot of things, and his big announcement January 11th was that he intends to keep on owning them, despite this presidency business or however anyone who isn't Donald Trump has ever done it. Whether it's the power of persuasion or the persuasiveness of power, it's not an unfounded concern that some in public life, including in the media, might provide insufficient challenge to the idea that worries about conflicts of interest are really just sour grapes. Reporter Russ Choma has been tracking Trump's conflicts for Mother Jones. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Russ Choma.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, I know that not everyone can cover everything, and there's a whole lot of ground to cover, but still, you're one of not very many reporters that have really fleshed out Donald Trump's conflicting interests rather than just sort of mention them or say that they're controversial or something like that. Before we talk about coverage, let's talk about some of the substance here. What, for you, are among the most significant and or troubling conflicts for the president-elect?
I think, first of all, the thing that probably troubles me the most is that we just don't know very much, or we know some, but not enough. Mm-hmm. He's disclosed his assets and his liabilities, but we're missing a lot of details. We're missing especially details on the debts, the liabilities. He reported, according to our reporting, about $713 million in debts to a number of banks. We don't know the details of these loans. We know that he's personally guaranteed some of the money. We don't know how much. We know that some of these loans have been turned around and sold off. We don't know everyone who owns the loans now. How much is he spending to make these payments? You know, we have some idea of his income. We have some idea of his net worth, but it's tough to say how much leverage people have on him. All of these things are things that concern me that we don't know. Getting a little more detail, getting his tax returns would help with all of this. But that's the first concern, is that we just don't know enough. I think that the next biggest thing is the debt. For me, and that's something that we've recovered a lot, is the debt. You know, he owes, his biggest lender is Deutsche Bank, which is a large German bank. They're financially troubled. They've also run into a lot of trouble with U.S. regulators. They just settled a $7.2 billion fine with the Department of Justice for the role that they played in creating bad mortgages and then packaging them in the lead up to the 2008 economic crisis. They're currently under investigation for the role that they've played in potentially helping Russians who were under sanction get money out of Moscow. The New Yorker had a really great piece this summer on basically what's essentially looked like money laundering. The Department of Justice is investigating them. They're his biggest lender. He's going to be in charge of the Department of Justice. How tough is he going to be on them? And this fall, when the question came up about their role in the 2008 mortgage crisis, when the Department of Justice initially said, we're going to be very, very tough. We want a fine of $14 billion. The bank almost went under. Its stock crashed. The German government had to announce that they were not going to step in and prop the bank up. I mean, it could have very quickly become an international crisis, an international situation. And if he owes these people money, $364 million by our count, he needs them to keep lending him money. That's a huge conflict. And to me, it's something you can't get around. You know, he can say he's not going to run his business anymore. He can turn it over to his children. But if he's personally guaranteed these loans and these lenders have this leverage over him, that's something you just can't get around unless you get rid of the loans and you get rid of the assets that you've mortgaged against them.
Well, I think that emphasis on, as you put it, not just what he owns, but what he owes is very interesting and an interesting point that's not being brought up so clearly, maybe in mainstream media coverage. But the conflicts are similar in that, you know, he owns Vegas casinos and, you know, they will be involved with the National Labor Relations Board and he's going to appoint members there. The nature of the conflicts between what you would look for a president to do politically and what choices he might make as a businessman or as an owner, the nature of the conflict is similar.
Right. I don't want to say that there aren't conflicts with what he owns.
No, not at all.
There absolutely are. And like you pointed out, like the National Labor Relations Board, I mean, that's been one that has come up, and it's sure to come up again, considering how many people are employed at his hotels. And then his foreign interests, the things that he owns overseas, I mean, all that, most of those aren't actually attached to any debt, but that's a good example of what he owns.
Right. Well, I'm not at all saying that media have ignored the issue, but the way stories present things, you know, we read about almost an appearance that might suggest to some a potential conflict. You know, it's almost like conflicts of interest are chimera, you know, and I think it's because on some level it's almost seen as a judgment call, like you're making a moral claim. You know, you might think he has a conflict of interest because you don't trust him, but it's really just a situational definition, isn't it? You're saying a person has two interests, they're competing. You're not even claiming that they're favoring one over the other, but it's not a kind of wait and see type of thing. It's just a kind of relationship that in itself presents a problem.
Right. Donald Trump keeps on saying this thing about, well, I'm the president, so I can't have conflicts of interest. And that's just not true. You may legally not be subject to the conflict of interest law, but the conflict is still there. The fact that Deutsche Bank is your biggest lender and Deutsche Bank is in trouble with the Department of Justice or potentially in trouble with the Department of Justice, that's a conflict. Now, the question becomes, can it be managed? Is it a big deal? Is it something to be concerned about? But it's a conflict. The other thing is with conflict of interest, and this is a big part of the thinking on all conflict of interest, is that you don't have to have an actual act of wrongdoing. You know, Donald Trump could act with the best intentions when it comes to Deutsche Bank. He could do everything that he's supposed to do. Deutsche Bank could not ask for any favors, could not pressure him at all. But as long as that conflict exists and people think that there's a possibility that something happened, you know, it's the appearance of a conflict that's just as important as the actual conflict. People are going to question him.
Well, after the press conference, headlines like Trump said ready to turn business over to trust run by Sons and Associate imply that some sort of meaningful concession was made. But these moves, the many documents he says he signed, making inside hires of ethical advisors, that doesn't really touch the key conflict that you're talking about, does it?
Right. I mean, we need a lot more detail. I mean, the ethics experts I spoke to said none of what he announced at the press conference actually addresses the core issues that need to be addressed. But even for those steps to do the things that he said, we need a lot more information. There's a concern with the Constitution that the Constitution says that federal office holders can't accept a financial benefit from a foreign government. Would that apply to his hotel in Washington, which foreign delegations seem to be rushing to rent rooms at? And his lawyer said, well, we'll donate the profits from any transaction with a foreign delegation to the U.S. Treasury. Well, what do you mean profit? I mean, are you counting the money that you make only after you pay all of your overhead, you pay your debt service, you pay your taxes? Because you could still take a lot of money before you get to that point. And how do we know that you're actually doing that? Are you going to open up your books? Are you going to make the hotel's books public? Are they going to be affected by FOIA? I mean, right. There's a lot of details before anything that he said yesterday can really be verified. And then even when it is, like I said, the ethics experts that I've spoken to say it doesn't actually meet the requirements that they think need to be made.
Right. Well, what can you tell us about congressional efforts to address this problem?
I guess the good news is that Congress can act if they'd like to, you know, with the power of hearings and oversight committees. And I think that, as we saw with Hillary Clinton's emails, and if members of Congress want to make something into a very big deal, they will.
Right.
And I spoke to one constitutional lawyer who said, if you thought that Hillary's emails were a big deal, wait till you see what they do with Trump's conflicts of interests. Now, that requires having members of Congress who want to do that. If he has support of Republicans who currently control both houses, they're not going to do anything. And right now, there are Democrats who are attempting to make a fuss, who are releasing press releases, who are sponsoring legislation. But without Republicans to go along with them, those hearings aren't going to get held. That legislation's not going to move. And so at the moment, it's sort of dead in the water. Now, we did see that when the Republicans moved to lessen the power of the Congressional Office of Ethics, which is not actually anything to do with Trump, a huge, huge response from the public where people called and, you know, swamped the switchboard, that actually had an impact. And so we've seen that members of Congress can be swayed by a public outcry, and that on the issue of ethics, there is a public concern, and the public wants our government to act ethically. So I think that it's not out of the question that Congress could take steps. They just need to be motivated. And I think right now the majority doesn't feel motivated, and the minority doesn't have a lot of options without help.
Well, finally, and directly to that point of possible sources of that motivation, what role do you see for reporters and for the public?
So this is something that I've been writing about for the last 18 months. I mean, I wrote my first stories about his personal finances back in July of 2015, about a week or two after he announced he was running. And for a long time, I felt like I was sort of a little bit alone on the beat. Lately, there have been a lot of people who have brought this up. His debt is finally becoming something people are talking about. And I think there is a lot of attention. I mean, I agree not all of it is always correct or productive, but I think the reporters have finally caught on. And I think the key is to keep working on it. But it's also easy to get frustrated. Having worked on it for so long and feeling like people weren't paying attention, sometimes you, as a reporter, you wonder, is this something worth pursuing? I think that we've seen that as interest has grown, as he got closer to the presidency, as some of these things became more obvious, the interest is there and it was worth it. But I think that reporters have to keep it up. And I think that reporters also have to find a way to continue to make it relevant, because there is people pushing back on this. I mean, Trump himself and all of his sort of entourage push back on the idea that he should have to do anything. And so I think that it's not going to be an easy thing for reporters. And the media doesn't always have a great attention span. And if you don't get immediate action, the media sometimes lets things go. And I'm lucky enough to work somewhere where I feel like we continue to pursue stories even when it's not the most obvious or popular thing to do. And I think hopefully other reporters will be able to do that as well.
We've been speaking with reporter Russ Choma. Follow his work on Trump's conflicts of interest and other issues at motherjones.com. Russ Choma, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
When seven people were arrested recently in Florida for serving free food to homeless people in a public park, it got a smattering of news coverage. One Wire report began by explaining that what many see as a charitable act is actually a legally complicated matter that could violate laws and even send you to jail. Well, the piece contends that the Florida activists found this out after the event. But of course, those people, members of the group Food Not Bombs, knew just what they were doing, along with the reasons that would be presented this time for their arrest. In troubling times, more people may be tempted or driven to participate in social change more directly. So what can we learn from the experience around food sharing and the state and the media response? Megan Hustings is director of the National Coalition for the Homeless. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Megan Hustings.
Thanks, Janine. Thanks for having me.
Well, homelessness, of course, is not new, and people giving food to homeless people and getting in trouble for it, that's not new either. And yet it seems like it's a moment when maybe more people than usual are thinking about the most vulnerable in society, and that we can't assume that government is going to help or protect them, and, you know, asking, what can I do? And feeding the hungry mm-hmm. sounds like a simple place to start. So give us some background on, well, first of all, maybe the importance of food sharing programs. Where they mm-hmm. exist, they do help people.
Yeah, and what's key about food sharing, especially as Food Not Bombs tends to do it, which is going out into the community, into parks where people congregate, is that it finds people where they are. We have someone a longtime advocate who is homeless himself, who always says that homeless people are the least lazy out there, because they have to walk, you know, 2 miles from the shelter to get their lunch and then 2 miles back to get dinner and come back at night. So oftentimes, even though there might be free food or meals available, they're not always convenient for folks who are staying outside. So those who do feed in public areas like parks are providing a very needed service.
Well, let's talk about the pushback on that, because mm-hmm. what one gets from the media coverage, which of course is kind of thin and occasional, is, oh, sure, it sounds like a good idea, but there's really these actually very good reasons that it's not a good idea. What forms do the restrictions tend to take?
They can take many forms. The restrictions that we know about have been anywhere from requiring a permit, which I believe is what is on the books in Tampa, a permit to share food, and sometimes that requires that you do it actually indoors or have some sort of facility where food prep is highly regulated. Orlando had a law on the books that said that you could not share food with more than 25 people in public places, so that folks were getting arrested when they handed out that 26th sandwich. In general, these ordinances have been around for a very long time. We've been tracking them for about 20 years. And what we see is that, in general, what communities are in effect doing is making homelessness less visible. Even though that might not be the outward intention, that's usually what happens. And in the case of Tampa, we have to mention that there was a large college football event earlier this week. And so it was odd that, even though there had been a law on the books for a very long time that police and the city had not responded by asking the Food Not Bombs folks to move along until there was the event that a lot of people would be paying attention to in the city and perhaps wanted not to see this kind of sharing of food or these, you know, quote-unquote types of people in their city.
Well, it fits together with what I know in the 2014 report that the coalition did, Share No More. Mm-hmm. You talk about kind of myths and motivations of the pushback. And there's a number of levels to it that you've touched on. One of them was reflected in, you know, a kind of otherwise good, straightforward story, but it referred to municipalities threatening or actually jailing groups that feed the homeless. And it said they're acting against, quote, private groups that work to serve food to the needy instead of letting government-run services do the job, close quote. That makes it sound as though there are these government services that could be feeding all of these people, and, you know, groups like Food Not Bombs are getting in the way of it. And I guess there's a problem there, which you've already pointed towards, of whether those programs really do exist or do meet all the needs that are out there.
Yeah.
So it's not, in other words, feeding people instead of letting the government do it. And sometimes it's feeding people instead of letting them be hungry.
You know? Or have to stress to find another way to eat.
Right, right. But then, perhaps more depressingly, there seems to be this idea that somehow helping homeless people in this sense and feeding them is creating or driving homelessness, as though if you didn't feed them, they wouldn't exist?
Yeah, and we find that very troubling, you know, especially troubling because homelessness has so many causes. And, you know, something that we have really highlighted in recent years with the increased number of encampments that are springing up across the country is there, first of all, there's not enough affordable housing in our communities, but also there's just not enough shelter either. And unfortunately, even federal funding has been, in recent years, kind of tailored more towards permanent supportive housing programs, which are extremely successful and really doing a great job of housing a small number of folks. And so there's a lot more people who are just not finding the resources or the help that they need on a daily basis.
So that's another piece of the problem. Mm-hmm. And then another piece that I guess kind of raises some questions about the idea that the restrictions are motivated by concern, you know, real concern and a desire to truly or more deeply help homeless people. That's kind of belied by other laws that we see on the books that affect homeless people. Can you tell us a little about some of the context of, you know, the other laws that people without homes are up against?
And this is definitely how we see it. We know some of our partners have slightly different perspectives. You know, it would really encourage folks to go to a service provider instead of someone who's feeding in a park so they could get further services. But again, I think what we see is not just restrictions on feeding, but also there's been lots of laws that restrict camping or sleeping, even sitting down in public places, you know, sitting on sidewalks or even benches. There's not just ordinances, but also subtle things that cities do, like putting armrests in the middle of public benches so that you can't lay down. Here in D.C., we have bus stop benches that have little dividers between the seats, and they're very, very skinny, so that it would be very difficult to lay down and be comfortable. So there's these little things here that are subtly saying we don't want to see people who are homeless in our cities and our downtown areas. You know, we're trying to try to move them along in any way we can. And we just think that this is really antithetical to ending homelessness and truly doing something to help people get off the streets. And we understand that there's a lot of cities, mayors, who get a lot of feedback from their community that homelessness is a large problem, but we're not going to solve it by saying you can't be homeless here. You know, that's not looking at all at the causes of why somebody is homeless or really what the issues are that are preventing them from getting and affording long-term housing.
Well, let me just ask you finally, I guess mm-hmm. folks who are motivated to do things, we're all going to have to decide what our relationship to the law should be when mm-hmm. we disagree with those laws. That's going to be a choice that I guess more and more folks are going to be making. Let me ask you, are there not things that municipalities themselves can do? You know, we hear about places making themselves sanctuary cities, you know, so maybe mm-hmm. there's going to be a federal law that's pressing deportation, but we're going to make a statement that in our community we're going to do things differently. Are there those sorts of tools available in terms of homelessness and feeding hungry people?
Most definitely. You know, at the root of homelessness is the lack of affordable housing. Communities across the country, we're all struggling to find housing that we can afford. So that's kind of at the basic level. We really need more advocacy from folks, calling your legislators. They really do actually want to hear from you. And being involved in advocacy efforts to really increase funding for affordable housing programs. There's also a number of cities who have endeavored to support encampments and folks who live in them while longer-term housing solutions are found. So there are some encampments across the country and some cities who have agreed to, you know, do things like trash pickup and mail delivery services even, you know, anything to provide the higher standard of living for folks who only have the ability to live outdoors or there's not a viable option for them to be indoors at the moment. So that's definitely something that we encourage. If there's more of a realization that there are positive things we can do to ultimately end homelessness while also supporting those individuals who are on the streets right now, that's much preferable to the alternative.
We've been speaking with Megan Hustings, director of the National Coalition for the Homeless. Find their work online at nationalhomeless.org. Thank you very much, Megan Hustings, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
The EU Copernicus Earth Observation Program has confirmed 2016 was by far the hottest year ever recorded. It was almost at the 1.5 degree alleged safe limit set at the Paris climate talks. We are already at the red line and still have our foot on the gas. A dangerous new climate is dead ahead. Human society in times of climate change is like a sinking boat taking on water. The crowds will rush from one side to the other. As we know, sometimes that causes the ship to tip, throwing everyone into the sea. Right now in America and Australia, and perhaps soon in the UK or Europe, the captains try to say, there is no problem. Donald Trump denies that climate change is happening. It's a hoax, he says, as he appoints fossil fuel people to regulate the environment, science, and energy. Of course, the physics of the melting ice world, the heating oceans, and rising seas don't care what he thinks. According to a Florida risk analysis agency, by the year 2045, Trump's so-called winter White House, called Mar-a-Lago, will be underwater 210 days a year. Maybe humans will make it a special dive site where you can visit and remember the American president who made the dumbest mistake in the world. That drowned resort will be a gold-plated monument to climate change denial. He'll be dead, of course, and so will millions of others, but that temple of excess under the sea will be a signal of the legacy of Donald Trump. At dozens of military bases, the American forces face the same problems of rising seas and more intense storm surges. Later in this program, we'll hear from Erica Spanger Siegfried at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She led a comprehensive report into the coming challenges to military bases as climate change unfolds. But first, we'll talk to a medical genius who can explain how and why denial is so easy to trigger in human beings. I'm Alex Smith. Here's this week's serving of Need to Know Information from Radio EcoShock. After decades of great science showing how climate change operates, we get an incoming American administration composed of climate science deniers. How is that possible? A listener suggested I contact Ajit Varkey about his book Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and the Origins of the Human Mind. So now we're in for a treat. We'll spend a little time with an awe-inspiring professor of medicine and pioneer researcher from the University of California in San Diego. Following his beginning in India, Ajit Varkey has led American explorations into cellular and molecular medicine. His multifaceted mind also ventures into the origins of humans and, as it turns out, a critical mechanism of human consciousness. Understand the role of denial, says Varkey, and you understand a lot about your own life and the civilization around us. Ajit Varkey, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Your meeting with Danny Brower and this book on denial shows to me that advances can be almost accidental or serendipitous at least. Tell us about Danny Brower.
Yeah, that's really a case of serendipity in science. I, as you mentioned, mostly study cellular and molecular medicine and cellular and molecular differences between humans and other species. But once in a while, I venture into sort of less familiar territory such as psychology and so on. And when you do that, you're guaranteed somebody will come and give them your opinion, their opinion. You know, everybody has an opinion about the human mind. And so I sat down for lunch at the University of Arizona 2005 after giving a lecture, and this bearded man sat next to me and said, "You're all asking the wrong question." And then I realized he was the chair of cell biology, Danny Brower, and he gave me this fascinating idea. I'd never thought about it before. And I suggested to Danny that he should write this up, and we sat there for an hour and a half after everybody's gone talking about it. But then I never heard from him again. And then a year later, I tried to contact him, still got no response, and I finally looked him up on the internet and found his obituary. And so not knowing what to do, since he had not published his basic idea, I wrote a letter to the journal Nature along with my own embellishments of his idea and extensions. And that was published in 2009, I believe. And shortly thereafter, I was contacted by his widow, who said, Sharon Brower, said, "Thank you so much. Can you please finish Danny's book?" And so I ended up with Danny's incomplete manuscript and done something I'd never done before, write a book with a man I'd met only for an hour and a half and who's no longer with us.
That is amazing. Well, let's get to the essential theory that you and Danny propose. Why do we humans need denial as a function of our intelligence?
So let's step back and acknowledge, I think you will, everybody will, it's not just climate change. We deny anything we don't like. You know, I study the mechanism by which red meat increases the risk of cancer and heart attacks, and yet 80% of the people in my lab eat red meat. And we could go on and on, right? Whether it be exercise, national debt, different levels of denial, but we're all in some form of denial or the other. So it's a very peculiar human characteristic, and it's never really been explained. There are many discussions about this, you know, different names for it, cognitive dissonance, other kinds of words used in different books written about this general phenomenon. But why would we end up with something like that? And that was the question that Danny approached in a new way. And the basic question he asked was something that I'd never thought about. You know, people like me have been looking for a long time to say, what made us human? What was that cognitive leap, or what were the series of genetic and biological changes that made it possible for us to, say, you know, run a radio station or whatever? And when you think about that, you assume that it was just natural selection gradually, you know, selecting for an improved mind. And Danny said you should not be asking that question. We've got birds, we've got elephants, we've got dolphins, we've got whales, we've got chimpanzees. I just described 200 million years or more of evolution where we had many, many smart, warm-blooded, social, complex, intelligent creatures. So he said you should not be asking what made us human. You should be asking what stopped everybody else. Why aren't we competing with a human-like elephant or a human-like dolphin or a human-like crow? Why is just one of us was one species taking over the planet? So that was the sort of counterintuitive idea he put in my head, which I'd never heard before.
And what is that barrier? I mean, what happened? It sounds from my reading of your book that a double leap happened.
Right. So after thinking about it further, and I realized that I coined a term in the book, a psychological evolutionary barrier. So we've all heard of physiological evolutionary barriers. For example, going from water to land, that's not easy and wasn't done many times. And you can't just, you know, walk out onto land and start living. You've got to have many things work just right. So it's a barrier. And there have been many such barriers in evolution that have been surpassed by complex processes of evolution. But when you have a barrier, many things have to go just right at the right time in order to break the barrier, as opposed to just gradual, you know, improvement by natural selection. So this psychological evolutionary barrier that Danny was positing has to do with something. We must begin with self-awareness. Now, all of the species I just mentioned, crows, corvid birds, elephants, dolphins, etc., can recognize themselves in a mirror. This kind of study has been done to varying extents, most convincingly in chimpanzees. They know who they are, just as we know who we are. So they would be like a 2 to 3 year old child who can recognize himself or herself in the mirror. So that's pretty close to where we are, after all. And more recently, it's been shown that they even begin to understand the minds of others. But this is the critical step. We not only understand the minds of ourselves, we understand the minds of others, and we can put ourselves in the mental shoes of others. So right now, I'm sitting at one end of a telephone talking to you who I have not met in person. You're listening to me and understanding what I'm saying, and if and when you broadcast this, a whole bunch of people across the world will understand what I said on this telephone. So that is called many words for it. It's called extended theory of mind would be the best word and the technical term. So in other words, you have a theory of my mind, I have a theory of your mind, I have a theory of the minds of your potential listeners. So when I'm speaking, I'm thinking about that, right? And all the other animals, all the chimpanzees were recently shown to be able to, and actually birds some time ago, to sort of understand the minds of others, fail at this extreme degree of extended theory of mind. And so that's the other conundrum that Danny, in a way, was positing. He was starting with self-awareness, but I developed it further in this manner. So you would think that this should be a good thing, right? Because we've taken over the world with it. Imagine, did you ever see a movie called Rain Man?
Yes.
So remember Dustin Hoffman is an autistic savant, very smart, very able, but can't communicate with others, you know, can't put himself in the mental shoes of others. Imagine if the whole world was full of people like that. There'd be a lot of very smart individuals, but culture would not progress. You know, you wouldn't have phone calls, you wouldn't have lectures, you wouldn't have radio shows and so on. And so that is a barrier which is worth breaching. And you would think that it should have happened multiple times during evolution, and it didn't. So the question is, why not? And the question is, you would, instead of saying that this is a good thing, I'm suggesting that the first time it happens to the first individual, it's actually not a great thing. So imagine if you're the first woman in Africa in ancient times, pre-human times, that got this ability. You can read the minds of others, right? You can, you should be able to dominate. You could tell lies. You could take over. You could fool everybody. Or imagine you're an elephant that's born with this ability. You could, you know, win all your battles because you can fake out others because you can read their minds. So it should be a good thing. So if it's such a good thing, it should have just automatically or you know, very quickly established itself, but it did not. So it turns out it's a terrible negative the first time. And I don't know if you, in reading the book, got the gist of why it's a terrible thing.
I did, but I'd like you to explain that to our listeners, and I think it involves the awareness of death, does it not?
Right. So imagine you're that woman who got theory of mind, and then she watches her sister die in childbirth, or watches her mate get eaten by a lion, or you're that elephant, and you watch your friend getting killed in a fight with another elephant. All of a sudden, this wonderful ability to read the minds of others gets translated into something unexpected. You just watch the death of another mind, a mind you knew as a person, not just as another entity you could react with. And having watched that, the argument is, and this is something that's difficult to prove conclusively, it's a theoretical argument, that you now realize your own mortality. You not only realize that death is possible, you realize that you yourself are going to die. Now, as a mammal, you already have built-in, or a warm-blooded creature, you already have built-in fears of death. You know, every animal has a built-in automated fear of death. It doesn't know it, but it reacts to it. All of a sudden, this negative feeling becomes dominant. So what are you going to do? You're that woman, you say, I'm not having a child. You're that elephant, you say, I'm not fighting the bull elephant. I'm not getting involved. I'm just going to chill out and relax and survive. Well, you won't pass your genes on. And if you don't pass your genes on, that's the end of your line. So this would be the barrier, basically, to obtaining a full extended theory of mind. The secondary recognition of personal mortality and the fear that arises from that. A more technical term would be mortality salience. So now the argument is that this has been happening for the last 100 million years. Every once in a while, a crow, an elephant, a dolphin is born with this ability. And having observed the death of others, essentially goes into sort of an existential crisis and gives up. And so you never pass the you know, so let's say this involves hundreds of genes that have to come together. You're not going to pass that ability on to anyone else. And so the solution to the problem is something else that should be negative, which is denial. If you think about it, independent of theory of mind, if an animal denies reality, if you're a wildebeest and you decide to go check out the lions, or anything else, any animal that denies reality too much is doomed. So that's a negative. So the argument is that you had these two negatives which occur randomly occasionally. One is denial of reality, which a simpler way of putting it is suppressed fear, increased risk-taking, etc., which could happen in a group of individuals or in one individual. But that by itself is not a good thing eventually. It's going to get you. Meanwhile, you have some other individuals who have developed this extended theory of mind, but who cannot tolerate the fear of death and other realities that they begin to realize, and they give up. So the argument we are making, Danny and I are making, is that this one time, in probably at the origin of modern humans, one group of individuals developed both theory of mind and reality denial, or suppression of fear or suppression of risk at the same time. And that combination gives you the magic path through the evolutionary barrier. So is that making sense?
It is. It is indeed. You know, you mentioned a movie, and it kind of reminds me of another movie, a 1997 movie starring comedian Jim Carrey. And that film is Liar, Liar. And Carrey finds he can't get through a single day in society without the ability to lie. You know, the truth and nothing but the truth makes social life impossible. Is that different from what you're talking about?
No, it's an extension of that. Once you get the ability to read the minds of others, you can now carry out deception, right, of the others, and vice versa, as the group evolves that. But in fact, initially it should be a bit unstable. As I haven't seen that particular movie, I've heard about it, but you can imagine if everybody told lies all the time, that wouldn't work either, right? So it is kind of related. Of course, there's another kind of lie, which is self-deception, right? Once you develop this ability, now you can deceive yourself. And as my colleague Pascal Gagnier put it, if you can deceive yourself about your abilities, that actually might not be a bad mating strategy, especially for a male. So these things could have come together at the same time.
Well, you know, you talked about the negativity of the trait of denial. And for me, as I began with this idea of an imminent threat like climate change, I'm worried that human evolutionary biology may end with our extinction if we don't get this act together. Do you think this innate and necessary trait of denial is something that could be trained or overcome in the face of a grave danger?
Yes, it can. By the way, before we go to that, there's an important corollary, which is the other peculiar thing about humans is we have this unusual optimism bias. Sometimes it's called the Pollyanna hypothesis. We always look at the bright side of life, most of us, except those who are depressed, the few individuals. But what is optimism? Denial of reality. What is extreme optimism? Extreme denial of reality. So things like optimism, confidence, courage, bravery, you know, which we give a lot of positive kudos to, are variations on this theme. So one of the things that came along with denial is risk-taking. And sometimes the risk-taking pays off. My grandfather was a friend of Gandhi. And I always wondered growing up, what was this man thinking? He's going to take on the British Empire with nonviolence? What a ridiculous idea. But then he succeeds, pays the price, but then theory of mind transmits that idea to Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King and so on. So anyway, that's a bit of a segue, but it's related because the problem we have in all these things, climate change being the absolute worst kind of denial, is that we need to be optimistic. If we're not optimistic, we don't succeed. It's been shown over and over again. You know, I used to run track. If you don't believe you're going to win, you're not going to win. So how do you have optimism and realism and pessimism in the same brain at the same time? So with climate change, by the way, I should again give credit to Danny. He's writing this in 2004, 2005, before he died. I'm sorry, about 2006 probably. And he's writing at that time, effectively. You know, we can deny many things and get away with it. But the one thing we can never get away with is denying climate change. Because everything else, be it national debt, healthcare, you know, disease, whatever, we can deny reality and eventually fix things. But there are two things we can't fix once they go wrong. One is nuclear holocaust, and we think we've contained that. We hope we have. And the other is climate change, because you can't go back. So on the one hand, we need to be realistic, and on the other hand, we need to be optimistic. And to specifically answer your question, the only solution is education. And unfortunately, that education has to come early on enough in someone's life for people to really, you know, appreciate it. I have friends in the climate change field and colleagues here at SIO, talk to them. And I keep telling them, use the word that you just used. We need fear. Maybe that's the only solution. But as you know, it's humans are generally optimistic and tend to ignore fear unless it really hits them in the face. So it's not an easy problem to solve.
It's what they call a wicked problem, I think.
That's right.
Well, you know, public knowledge of denial has been heavily influenced by the 1969 book On Death and Dying. That was by the Swiss psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And she, like you, worked with terminally ill patients. But Kubler-Ross suggested denial was a stage we can work through. I think you're talking about something very different. Am I right?
Yeah, this is not really... See, there's no true correct word for this. Denial is reality denial, ignoring, rationalizing. It's a combination of all these things. It's something that's built in. It's not a stage in a progression of thinking. It's just built into us as humans. Otherwise, after you had a near-death experience on the freeway, why would you go out and drive next day, right? Everything would shut down. So we need this. But when it comes to climate change, unfortunately, we only have one chance to do it right, and it's maybe already too late. But the question is, how do we communicate this to everyone else?
Our guest on Radio EcoShock is Ajit Varkey, professor of medicine at the University of California and co-author of the book Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and Origins of the Human Mind. Well, as you said, there's so many applications to the operation of denial. I'm thinking of smokers who keep smoking, or that one in three Americans is now obese, despite well-known medical risks of that. If denial is at the core of our ability to keep going, it also seems to be something that tobacco, food, and energy corporations can take advantage of for their profit. Ajit, from a doctor's perspective, are we being used precisely because denial can be triggered so easily?
Oh, absolutely. You can go further. It's only recently because of social norms that doctors stop smoking. You know, I just looked it up, 40% of Chinese cardiologists smoke cigarettes. So it's very easy for anybody who wants to purvey denial of any kind. So in other words, the human mind just grabs at denial. Anything that makes us feel a little bit better about something that we should be taking seriously, we'll grab at that. And so you're right that whether it be food or tobacco or any number of things, it is very easy to manipulate the human mind in the direction that one wants in this regard.
And how does this work? Do we draw a curtain? Do we move something to a special closet? Do we create comforting counter-arguments? Ajit Varkey, did you and Danny find anything about that?
No. So the question is, at the end of the day, to prove this hypothesis, you need, the standard dogma in science these days is don't make a hypothesis unless you can experimentally prove it. And this is a case where we cannot experimentally prove it overnight because we can't recreate evolution. But if I were to guess at what happened is, there's a book called The Optimism Bias by Tali Sherratt, who talks about the human optimism. And it turns out that deep in our brains is a place called the amygdala, where fear responses are handled in most animals and humans. And we have a way, it appears, of sending good news to the amygdala very fast and bad news very slowly. It's just a disconnect, which most other animals apparently don't have. So it could be that there are pathways in our frontal lobes and in our amygdala which may be discovered that are uniquely human. And by the way, that happens to be one of the areas where there are specific human changes that might explain this. Now, someday can that be used, pharmacologically or technically or in some way to interrupt that process? Yes, but then you're at a risk of losing your optimism. So it's a tricky problem. So obviously, like anything else in science, until we finally understand it, we won't be able to know what to do about it. So right now, unfortunately, we don't have the time, and we have to go with what we have, knowing that humans have this ability. And I'm sure I'm not an expert enough to comment further on that aspect, but I'm sure that expert psychologists can probably come up with ways that would, have a greater effect. I mean, one thing I suggested to a colleague of mine who's a climate change person, I said, if you tell people about, 2-degree rises of temperature or global changes in hurricanes and all that, it sort of, they think about it and they don't bother to do anything. If you tell somebody that your local climate is going to change in a way that's going to affect you and your family and your livelihood in a major, major ways, that may have a bigger impact. So I'd like to imagine that if everybody in the world could look at the projection for climate in their own personal space in the next 20 years, and such projections are possible, most people might be horrified to see what they see. So maybe, just maybe, that may induce sufficient fear that people may take it seriously.
Ajit, what is anthropogeny and why does it matter?
I stumbled into this field because I found the first difference between humans and chimpanzees. And anthropology is the study of humans. Anthropogeny is an old term which had fallen to disuse, which I've resurrected, which is the study of the origin of humans. In other words, where did we come from and how did we get here? And I think sounds like a cliche, but, unless you know where you came from, you don't know where you're going, right? And in the case of humans, we have a broad picture of the things that happen in terms of fossil evidence and timing. We kind of know where we came from, et cetera. But the details are far from clear. And even less clear is how our mind evolved. So it seems to me that for every point of view, not just climate change, if we survive climate change, social engineering, how people deal with life and everything, we need to understand where we came from. So anthropogeny is sort of this broad quest using all possible lines of evidence to understand not just who we are, but how did we get here and where did we come from.
Well, I'll put a link in my EcoShock blog to CARTA, the Center for Academic Research and Training in Anthropogeny.
Yes, that'd be great.
Okay. Well, we're starting to run out of time, but, I'm impressed with your whole career. I'd love to chat with you about your early discovery of that genetic difference between chimps and humans or your investigations into glycobiology. Do you have time to spend a couple of minutes just to explain to our listeners what glycans are and why you're looking into that?
Yeah, basically everybody's heard about DNA, RNA, and proteins, and maybe lipids and fats. And so you think that's what makes up a human. And sure, that is at the core of making up a living thing. But every single cell in nature, bar none, is covered with a dense and complex array of sugar chains. So if you looked at a cell, any cell in nature, it would not look like the planet Mars. It would look like the planet Earth, and everything that's green would be green and blue would be sugars. So this area of glycoscience or glycobiology, as it's sometimes called, got left out in the molecular biology revolution because it was too difficult. So I've characterized it as the dark matter of the biological universe. And so a few of us are sort of exploring this area. And it has, as you can imagine, given the ubiquity of these molecules, it has impact on just about every biological process and disease. But it's still not in the forefront of molecular and cellular biology. And so that's the other part of my career I've spent time on.
And now it's 4 years since the publication of the book Denial. Is it starting to advance into the general theory of human consciousness? Is it going somewhere?
No, there are two problems with the book, three problems actually. The first was that it's a book by a dead insect geneticist, which is Danny Brower, and a physician scientist who claimed to have found the answer, right? So we're the wrong people. The second was that I was not prepared to do this in the sense I was prepared mentally, but not in terms of my time constraints. And so I felt I had to get this book out, and I probably did a bit too hastily. And so it's not that I'd say I've written better things in my life. It's all the facts are there, but it's not your nice smooth read like it should have been. It wasn't fully edited the way it should have been and so on. And the third is, by the time I was done doing it, I was so tired because I was falling behind on so many other things that I didn't really do what, a book author is supposed to do, right? Go out on the road and give talks and go to bookstore signings and go on TV shows and so on. And so a lot of that was not done. So in that sense, this is, the book did reasonably well, but it certainly didn't hit the limelight. And unfortunately for popular books, if you don't hit the limelight, you know, it can sit there for years before people find it. So I'd like to imagine that someday, you know, I'm hoping in my lifetime to follow up on it, but if I don't, then someday hopefully people will look back and say, oh, actually Brower and Warkey figured it out, but you'll never know. I won't be there to know that, so.
Well, in my opinion, it's definitely time to revive this book, Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and the Origins of the Human Mind. I'll put links for our listeners at where they can find it at ecoshock.org. And you can find links to our guests and this whole discussion in that same blog. Dr. Warkey, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. I really appreciate it.
Sure, it's my pleasure. I hope it has some effect.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Thanks to you as a listener, I have the privilege to talk with many very smart men and women around the world, but I'll seldom say that we've met with true genius as we did this time with Ajit Warkey. When I began to review his published scientific papers, I was astounded. There are hundreds, too many to count, going all the way back to 1977, over a dozen this year, many are published in the top scientific journals in the world. Ajit Warkey has his own lab at the University of California, where he is surrounded by very bright young minds. You can find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Look for yourself. As you heard in this interview, I also find the kind of humility that can accompany true genius. Ajit Warkey knows what he doesn't know, and he has a sense of looking into difficult, dark places where humans have not been before. Dr. Warkey is not a climate scientist, but he's in touch with the field, and he knows this is one we must get right, and we can never go back if we don't. I hope you'll find and spread this interview through your own social media and friends. It explains so much about how denial flourishes all around us in so many ways. This interview was suggested to me by Rob Milkarski, who blogs at undenial.wordpress.com. Rob has prepared a short summary of Warkey and Brower's work. It's an excellent doorway. You can search for Undenial, Warkey, and Short to find it, or get the link in my EcoShock Show blog. Rob has also posted a longer summary of this theory of human denial, as written by Ajit Warkey and Danny Brower. Surf Rob's Undenial blog or get the link from my EcoShock show blog. It's worth your effort to get this, to see how we manage to deny so many realities. It's a wonder we survive at all.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
The climate threats faced by the American military are many, and they know it. In fact, climate issues are rising up in armed forces training and long-range planning. Of course, that's one of the problems we face. The climate fundamental to so many things is changing slowly, but can manifest itself as surprising shifts. One of the most slow-moving, but most inevitable and life-changing impacts is the expansion of oceans as the world warms. If you look at a map of America, it's dotted with over 1,200 military bases. Many of these, especially for the Navy, are located right at tide level. Tide level is going up, and so are storm surges, as we saw with Hurricane Sandy. The Union of Concerned Scientists is reliable and authoritative in my experience. Early this year, they issued a major report, The U.S. Military on the Front Lines of Rising Seas, 2016. The lead author and project manager for that report is Erica Spanger Siegfried. She's a senior climate analyst in the Climate and Energy Program for the UCS. Erica, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. I'm happy to be with you.
Why did the Union of Concerned Scientists decide to investigate and report on rising seas and the military?
Well, the short answer is that this is part of a larger effort on our part to build awareness of important climate risks that our country's facing and to build support for action to curtail these risks. So that's action both to adapt to climate change and to mitigate or dampen climate change.
Did your group interview military personnel? And if so, were they interested and cooperative?
Yeah, this was one of the most interesting aspects of the project in my mind. So we reached out to each of the 18 military bases that we worked with over a couple of months to points of contact there. And we spoke both in person and over email with a number of military personnel, as well as folks from the broader military community. And we connected with people from just over half of the bases. And for the most part, they were very interested and engaged and informed and really helpful, including instances of offering us a tour of the base and briefing us on preparedness actions and plans that they were rolling out. I would say in just under half of the sites, we were not successful in connecting with folks.
So your study explored 18 sites, as you say, the most at-risk bases in 9 states, all of them on the East Coast. And it's not just the Navy, but the Marines and the Air Force who have to adapt. Would you please just take a minute to read off the list of states and bases for us?
Certainly. So starting from the south and working our way north, we began the very southernmost point with Naval Air Station Key West. Also in Florida, we looked at Naval Station Mayport and on the west coast of Florida, Eglin Air Force Base. In Georgia, we looked at Hunter Army Airfield and the Naval Submarine Base at Kings Bay. In South Carolina, we looked at Marine Corps Recruit Depot at Parris Island and the Marine Corps Air Station at Beaufort. We looked at Camp Lejeune, Marine Corps Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. In Virginia, we looked at 3 installations, Joint Base Langley-Eustis, which is Air Force, Naval Air Station Oceana-Damnach Annex, and, no surprise, Naval Station Norfolk. We looked in Washington, D.C. at Joint Base Anacostia-Bowling, as well as the Washington Navy Yard. In Maryland, we looked at the Naval Academy, and in New Jersey at the U.S. Coast Guard Station Sandy Hook. And then jumping up to Maine, we looked at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard.
Erica, why are your case studies all located on the East Coast with none from the West Coast?
Well, you know, if we had to do over, we might do it differently. But originally, this work was focusing on the risk of storm surge from hurricanes. And the model that we chose to use simply isn't available or applicable to the West Coast. The West Coast doesn't typically experience hurricanes. The tool we were using was NOAA's SLOSH model, which was more applicable to East and Gulf Coast. However, we pretty quickly expanded the scope of our analysis to ask other questions beyond storm surge, like will increased tidal flooding affect these bases? Do these bases risk losing land permanently to rising seas? And the answer to both of those was a pretty resounding yes, and we know that those risks are faced on the West Coast as well. So we really hope that there's some follow-on work that can analyze risks to those bases.
It seems to me the poster child for a major base at risk of wrenching and expensive changes has to be the big naval port that you raised at Norfolk, Virginia. It's the world's biggest, with 7 miles or 11 kilometers of pier and wharf space. The world's naval powerhouse is there, with everything from aircraft carriers on down. Are there signs of rising seas at Norfolk already?
Certainly there are, and I would broaden your scope a little bit to the city of Norfolk, which, together with Miami, is kind of a poster child for sea level rise. It's one of those places where so-called sunny day flooding has started to become really obvious in recent years. The Norfolk area has seen almost 9 inches of sea level rise just since 1970. And during that time, the days with flood events have gone from roughly 1 per year to about 9 per year today. And our analysis earlier, a 2014 analysis that we conducted, showed that that's about to increase very steeply, so that they would see, you know, 40 a year just by 2030 and 180 in the lifetime of a home mortgage 30 years from now. So there are certainly signs of sea level rise there in Norfolk, and the base is experiencing some of that flooding as well. The base has a number of piers with electronic equipment underneath. The frequency of tidal flooding threatens that equipment. It's within reach. And several years ago, the base actually began to renovate its piers to respond to this. So there's a great awareness in the Norfolk area of sea level rise, and there's action underway both within the larger municipality and the naval station itself.
And what have you heard about the plans for the Norfolk Naval Base for the longer-term future?
Well, Norfolk Naval Base is part of a larger regional planning effort that's underway, and I think that a lot of important ideas will come out of that. I'm sure that the base itself has plans that it's intending to roll out, or I assume that it does. But one thing that is kind of taking root in the military community at this point, one idea that we're starting to see reflected in their decision-making, is this growing interest in engaging in planning with the surrounding community, recognizing that the base isn't an island and the ability of the surrounding community to function during times of flooding and other climate impacts is vitally important to the functionality of the base. That's the kind of thinking we're starting to see in some places. It feels very important, and it's terrific to see the military pioneering some of that. So, yes, the Navy is studying the future of Naval Station, among other installations, and this larger Hampton Roads Planning District Commission is participating with them in a joint study.
Well, Erica, you know that scientists are having some disagreements about how much sea level will rise and how soon. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change estimates are known to be a bit low now due to new science coming in, especially about rapid melting of glaciers in Greenland and Antarctica. How did your report handle the different possible scenarios?
This was a really key decision for us. We opted not to use the IPCC scenarios for the reasons you cite. We instead went with the scenarios used in the 2014 National Climate Assessment, which were developed by NOAA, our National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And we chose two of those scenarios, one that's just sort of a historic extension of sea level rise, which is not scientifically useful. There's a lower scenario, which doesn't factor in ice melt in a meaningful way, which we also felt was not useful, given that we're seeing an accelerating rate of ice melt. We chose to use two of the higher scenarios, what the National Climate Assessment calls the intermediate high, which assumes a moderate rate of ice sheet melt that increases over the course of this century and ultimately gets to just under 4 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. But we also felt, given the rapidly evolving science around the melting of land-based ice, that it was important to include the highest scenario. That scenario assumes much more rapid ice sheet loss and projects an ultimate rise of over 6 feet above 2012 levels by the end of this century. Those, of course, are global increases. And when we look up and down our coasts, we see, because of local sea level rise rates, we see even higher increases than those in some locations.
Yes, part of the East Coast is actually sinking. The land has subsidence.
That's right.
Well, tell us about one more case of a study of the military in this time of rapid climate change. Give us some details. What did you find?
Oh, there are so many interesting stories to tell here. I will avoid focusing on, you know, maybe the kind of canary in the coal mine of Naval Air Station Key West, which faces really stark land loss projections this century. One that was a bit of a surprise for me is Marine Corps recruiting depot in Parris Island. Actually, I have a neighbor next door who headed off there just about a week ago for boot camp for the next few months. This is one of, I believe, two of these camps where Marines do the bulk of their initial training in the country. And it's extremely exposed to sea level rise. We found that the increase in tidal flooding over the course of the century. Later this century, water levels could inundate 85% of Parris Island's land area. That includes some areas that may be technically wetland, but it also includes developed areas. That would happen about 10 times a year under the highest scenario. And Parris Island is already prone to flooding, but if we were to see under the highest scenario over 6 feet of sea level rise, by the end of this century, three-quarters of Parris Island's land would be inundated with the daily high tide. So obviously, important decisions will need to be made much sooner than 2100 when you're talking about three-quarters of the land area being effectively underwater twice daily. But we found that to be striking and not an isolated finding. We see similar projections in other locations along the coast.
Maybe they'll have to change it from a marine base to a submarine training base, but Okay, you found Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about the impact and preparedness of climate change by the U.S. military. Our guest is Erica Spanger Siegfried from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Well, in that Union of Concerned Scientists report, you discovered sea level rise is not just one threat, but really three. Could you explain that a bit?
Sure. I'm glad that came through in our work. Yes. So sea level rise raises the overall water level in the oceans, but the way that affects us depends on where we are and depends on where we are in time as well. So now, today, and in the near-term future, sea level rise is just making it possible for simple high tides with no storm involved to reach higher than normal and to flood our roadways, to reach into neighborhoods, to flood commercial districts. We saw this in downtown Boston and in cities up and down the East Coast with the November King Tide. We expect to see it again. So tidal flooding's here now. It's especially an issue for low-lying communities, but really up and down our coast, including the Gulf and West Coast, it's here. Now and in the future, sea level rise has made it possible for storms to be more damaging by giving storm surge just that much more water to work with and to reach into and damage our coastlines. Studies have shown that damage from Hurricane Sandy was increased by millions of dollars because of sea level rise. This is a very real threat, and it's a threat that will grow over time. And then, of course, we need to ask, well, where is this going? With tidal flooding reaching further into communities, the threat longer term and later this century really is of permanent land loss and of hard choices that communities will be forced to face in some cases about, do we invest heavily to defend this location and stay in place? Do we invest heavily to try and accommodate and live with the water? Or do we think about retreating from this space and relocating elsewhere? So it really is those three ways that sea level rise is poised to, and it is in the opening stages of reshaping our coastlines.
I'm glad you raised storm surge, because I think that's sort of the advanced man, the advanced team for rising seas. And when Hurricane Sandy roared up the East Coast in 2012, scientists projected a record storm surge, but they weren't sure where it would happen. That depended on where the storm hit. What does the U.S. military do to protect equipment from storm surges, and what more could they do?
Well, the military certainly is aware of its storm surge risk, and it's produced some really terrific new research to try and provide decision makers within its ranks better information to gauge those risks and to plan around those risks. You know, we only have a little bit of a peek under the hood in terms of what the military is currently doing or planning to do. But we do know that they're undertaking really practical things. Langley Air Force Base in the Hampton Roads, for example, which is highly exposed to storm surge today, has been doing things like raising electrical transformers and HVAC units, removing mechanical rooms from the basements and putting them, elevating them, installing flood barriers at entrances to important facilities, installing pumping systems that can help during times of flooding. There are also efforts underway by the military to improve their ability to understand their risks and to predict future flood risks. Langley, again, to cite that example, has partnered with NASA to develop a flood tool to more accurately predict, really down to the building level, their risk of inundation during storm surge.
Did you attempt to add up the possible economic costs of repairing and then in some cases replacing military infrastructure due to rising seas?
We did not. Our work focused really pretty strictly on the exposure of the land, the physical space. And we really stopped short of saying in detail what we thought the military should do in response to this. They're certainly the better decision makers when it comes to that. And we didn't attempt to describe in detail what was at risk in terms of facilities and the impact that that would have on readiness and operations. But, you just look at the replacement value of a place like Naval Station Norfolk. A 2013 DOD study puts that value at about $5.5 billion for one base. And, of course, there are a great many at risk.
Well, I think it's hard for anyone living outside America to imagine the stores, the services, the real estate markets that are locked into nearby bases. Some cities, even states, might crash without that income. And that's why, you know, in Congress, they don't like to close bases, even when there are calls to do that. Frankly, I think the cost of rising seas will be astronomical. They'll challenge not just America, but global civilization. Every coastal city, every megacity feels that stress and damage. Do you think I'm going too far?
Well, I think that's a reasonable characterization if you're looking out over the long term and if we don't do anything or do not nearly enough, certainly. The cost of inaction could include trying to defend and, in some cases, abandoning major cities, you know, astronomical costs. And many of the most vulnerable places are outside of the U.S., for sure. You know, megacities in South and Southeast and East Asia are highly exposed to sea level rise. I think, though, that if we are mitigating climate change as energetically as we can and really preparing for the changes we can avoid, it's still going to cost us. But ideally, we would be able to absorb these costs over time and make the necessary changes to our cities over time. This is the challenge ahead.
Has the military responded in any way to your report, or how about American legislators?
Yeah, well, so a panel of military experts convened by the Center for Climate and Security, just as one example, drew extensively from our results in a recent report that they used to summarize the sea level rise threat to coastal military installations and therefore preparedness and readiness on operations. That was a panel of very senior retired military folks. But we did have some very positive response from military itself. The Department of Defense spokesperson had complimentary things to say about our work, and our work was cited. There were articles in the Navy Times and the parallel papers for the other, at least one other branch of the military covering the report, which I thought was really a positive thing. And yes, we did hold a number of briefings on the Hill about our results, and the response really was quite positive, and most of those folks that we spoke with agreed that military and national security should be prioritized in light of sea level rise, that preparedness measures are really vitally important in light of this threat.
A couple of scientists we've had on this show have told us that rising seas and not actual heat is the biggest near-term threat of climate change. Would you agree with that?
I guess I'd put it a little bit differently. Yes, sea level rise is a huge threat, but unless you're in the eye of the storm today, the odds of which remain thankfully small, it's not currently a life or death threat for most of us. Higher global temperatures, on the other hand, are really turbocharging the global water cycle and leading to a range of extreme events, extreme precipitation in some places, which can be incredibly destructive. Extreme droughts and wildfires in other locations also can be deadly and incredibly destructive. And if you're simply talking about heat and not the follow-on extremes that can follow global average heat increases, then heat waves are, of course, very dangerous and responsible for many tens of thousands of lives lost in the summer of 2003 heat waves in Europe, some of which have been attributed to climate change. So I think sea level rise may be the more visible and present danger, and I feel that it's vitally important for us to grapple with. It's not necessarily the most dangerous at the moment, I guess is what I would say.
Does the Union of Concerned Scientists intend to keep watching this issue?
Absolutely. We are keenly aware that the rate of sea level rise is poised to reshape our coastline this century and even in the coming decades, depending on how quickly land-based ice melts, how quickly sea level rises. And in the next couple of years, you know, maybe it's 5, maybe it's 10, we hope that the science around that pace of sea level rise comes into much clearer focus, and we can speak more authoritatively, more helpfully to planners and communities about the space in which they have to respond, the time frame in which they have to respond, and the kinds of measures that will be most useful.
Erica Spanger, Siegfried, can you tell us about any projects that you're working on? And also, what are the aims of the Climate and Energy Program where you work?
Certainly. Well, our work so far on sea level rise has led us to some important findings, but honestly not entirely satisfying findings. I spoke about the tidal flooding results that earlier work has generated. And these show incredibly dramatic increases in tidal flooding in many locations, you know, hundreds of times per year. But what we don't know is what that means for that place. What is, again, the response space in terms of years that communities have to work with? When do they need to start making some really tough choices? We're digging deeper into that this year with a new analysis, and I'd love it if you'd stay tuned for that. In terms of the aims of our program, you know, at the end of the day, we want a livable climate. We want, among other things, to see global warming kept well below 2 degrees Celsius. And to get there, we need to ambitiously be reducing heat-trapping emissions, and we need to prepare for unavoidable changes. So we think those things are doable, but we know that they require really broad-based political support that doesn't exist in as broad and deep and ambitious way as it needs to in order to get this done. So, you know, sharing new science and analysis to mobilize that kind of support, that kind of ambition, is one of the key things we're trying to do.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
Yes, I would say that most of your listeners recognize, you know, whatever views they may hold, that things are about to change, certainly here in the U.S., and an administration that's been committed to action on climate change is to be replaced by one that has given pretty clear indications it wants to pull hard in a different direction, and even that it devalues climate science. We hope that that doesn't prove to be the case, but those are early indications. I think it's going to be vital that many people work in whatever way they can to try to defend the role of science, and for that matter, the role of simple objective truth that's so important to a healthy democracy.
Well, listeners, the American military itself faces a new threat, and it's not foreign. Right at home, dozens of military bases are faced with rising seas due to climate change. And we've been talking with Erica Spanger Siegfried. She is the lead author for the report, The U.S. Military on the Front Lines of Rising Seas 2016. That's from the Union of Concerned Scientists at ucsusa.org, ucsusa.org. And you can find links to the things we've been talking about in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Erica, thank you so much for helping us out on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Back around Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, some of his $409,000 in 2016 property taxes will go toward 12 reworked pumps expecting to grab up to 1 million gallons a minute from extreme rainfall and rising seas arriving right there in Palm Beach, Florida. The city work crews, surrounding Florida mayors, and insurance companies don't doubt the impacts of climate change for a minute. They are already dealing with it as the king tides flood more streets, homes, and businesses. And we're waiting for the big storm like Sandy to hit Florida. Donald Trump has properties on the front line of climate impact in several parts of the world, whether he wants to admit it or not. Maybe he won't live to see it, but young people, including all his children, will.
Hey, kids.
Be the first to join the Mar-a-Lago Dive Club. You know, the legend of King Canute, the British king who ordered the tides to stop. He failed at that, but his story lives on 1,000 years later. I doubt that Donald will be remembered that long. We don't know if a human civilization with memory will survive to that time, or even humans at all. That may depend on the passengers on this sinking ship running to the other side, the side of intense and urgent climate action as a basis to all of society. I hope we all live long enough to see that. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening this week and for caring about our world.
Then our flight from reality and from the ideals of our founders will get this globe of ours torn to hot flinders spinning gases. To us citizens of Green Prairie, this promise of inferno poses a simple question. What new folly can you dream up with your coffee, your grapefruit, your first cigarette to keep yourself a while longer from facing the truth?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next. Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll be featuring audio from a presentation earlier this year at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., featuring Rahul Saxena of Palestine Legal and Omar Shaker of the Center for Constitutional Rights. They're talking about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, its growth, and its role as a powerful organizational tool, and the current legislative efforts in the U.S. to try and suppress and punish BDS activists and activism.
Hi, everybody. I'm Rahul Saxena from, I'm a staff attorney at Palestine Legal, and thank you for having me, and thank you all for coming. So I, as Omar mentioned, I'm going to talk a little bit about anti-BDS legislation, and I am going to try to not be a pessimist about it. I'm going to try to be optimistic. Palestine Legal, just for some background, our mission is to protect and defend the civil and constitutional rights of people in the U.S. who speak out in favor of Palestinian freedom. We have four staff attorneys. We're kind of scattered across the country. I'm based in Chicago. I went to law school here in D.C., so I'm very happy to be back. So today I'm going to try to cover these five topics. If I go on and on and on, please just tell me to hurry up. I'll try to be relatively quick. But I want to talk a little bit about the legal background, the legal basis for the BDS movement, to put the BDS movement in the legal context. And then I want to talk about the suppression of BDS. First, by talking about the broader context of that suppression, that we, with the Center for Constitutional Rights, as Omar mentioned, that we covered in this report called The Palestine Exception to Free Speech. And then I want to talk about what we refer to as the two different waves of anti-BDS legislation. The first wave in 2014, the second wave, which we're currently experiencing, 2015 and 2016. And finally, I want to end with our legal response and also the organizing response that we've seen to these anti-BDS legislative initiatives. So is there anybody here from the Freedom to Boycott groups in Maryland or Virginia? Okay, so maybe when I get to the organizing part, I can hand it over to you to talk a little bit about what you successfully did organizing against some BDS legislative initiatives here. Okay, so first, a little bit about the First Amendment. How many people here are lawyers? I know this is D.C., so probably a lot of you. Okay. So this, what is the First Amendment, and why do we have the First Amendment? What is the First Amendment?
Free speech.
Free speech, religion, yeah. The First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution protects the rights to freedom of religion and freedom of speech from government interference. I'm going to focus mostly on the speech part. Now, why is that important? Why is the speech aspect of the First Amendment important to our society? Exactly. Legitimate, equal dialogue, free of government censorship or suppression. I think about my work at Palestine Legal often in terms of not just us being an organization that supports Palestinian freedom, but also a pro-democracy organization. I think that as a democracy, we call ourselves a democracy, although that could be debatable. I think that a foundational aspect of what a democracy is the fact that we have open debate, we have open dialogue, and we're allowed to challenge each other's opinions and beliefs and viewpoints, especially on important political issues. And if we don't have that, then we don't have democracy. And a democracy thrives. A democracy is strongest when we're allowed to challenge each other's ideas, when we're allowed to have a marketplace of ideas where ideas and expression is challenged. That's kind of the foundational basis, I think, of democracy. But when one side of a debate is silenced, it hurts not just our ability to challenge our society's opinions and beliefs on that issue, it hurts democracy as a whole. And that's what we're seeing when it comes to Palestine, the dialogue about Palestine in this country. And so what is speech? Speech, you know, the Supreme Court has held that speech is not just what we say. It's not just our words. It's also our expressive conduct. So, you know, the political statement I wear on my T-shirt, or the street theater, or the art that I have outside, or a sign that I hold, a poster that has a political statement. And in 1982, the U.S. Supreme Court held that boycotts, this country has a long tradition of boycotts, but, you know, boycotts that use legal means, you know, not riot or revolution, I think the Supreme Court said, but legal means to bring about political, economic, and social change, to vindicate rights are protected by the First Amendment. So the BDS movement, our right to advocate for boycotts of Israel, our right to advocate for BDS, is something that is protected by the First Amendment. And I think our Supreme Court has been very, very clear on that. Keep that in mind. So now I'm going to talk about the suppression of that right. As it's been mentioned, we worked with the Center for Constitutional Rights to release this report called The Palestine Exception to Free Speech, in which we documented what we see is what is actually a campaign to suppress Palestine advocacy in this country. And it happens in many forms. So when I say suppression, so in 2015, Palestine Legal, we responded to something like 240 incidents of suppression of Palestine advocacy in this country. The vast majority of that suppression happened on college campuses. I think 80% happened on college campuses, because that's kind of where the BDS movement is right now the most active. But when I say suppression, what do I mean? Some of the tactics that we've seen that we documented in this report include censorship of Palestine advocacy, or even censorship of Palestine symbols. Some of you may remember the case of the GW student right on the corner here who was asked to remove his Palestine flag from his window just a few months ago, when there were clearly other flags hanging from windows. So not just censorship, but also disparate treatment. School administration after school administration after school administration is pressured by Israel advocacy groups to crack down on Palestinian advocacy, treat them differently than they do other student organizing. False accusations is a big one. False accusations of anti-Semitism based exclusively on speech critical of Israel. And on the flip side, false accusations of support for terrorism based on speech supportive of Palestinian freedom. Bureaucratic barriers, school administrations setting up these hurdles that SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, have to go through, seems kind of like a, you know, maybe not a big deal, but it's actually quite nefarious. And the intent of it is to chill speech, to dissuade students from organizing Palestine-related events. Disproportionate punishment against Students for Justice in Palestine, cancellation of events, and a big one that Omar alluded to is threats of meritless lawsuits. So in that context, in the context of this like campaign to suppress Palestine advocacy across the country, Omar mentioned that suppression, you know, the goal of it is to squash the debate, is to squash speech in favor of Palestinian freedom. And now we're increasingly see that suppression happening in state legislatures across the country. So this is a map of the states that just in the past few months have introduced, or in some cases passed, anti-BDS legislation. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what I mean by anti-BDS legislation. The dark blue ones. Sorry, that's a good point. it's almost 50-50.
quite a few in the north.
Yeah, quite a few in the north.
California.
Yeah. I'll talk a little bit details about what exactly I mean by anti-BDS legislation, and I'll talk a little bit about which ones have passed and what they do. But I think it's important to remember as I'm talking about this, and this is where my optimism is going to come through. Is remember that our First Amendment protects our right to advocate for BDS. Our First Amendment protects our right to engage in boycotts. And no bill, no law, no bill, no state legislative initiative can can overwrite that constitutional protection. So going back to what happened in 2014, does anybody remember in terms of anti-BDS legislation? What kind of bills were we seeing and why? Exactly. So I think at the tail end of 2013, the American Studies Association passed their BDS resolution. And within weeks, we saw bills being introduced in a few states. I think it was New York, Maryland, and Illinois, seeking to punish the ASA. And they did that by threatening to defund schools or reduce funding for schools, reduce state funding for schools that housed an ASA or housed an association that that passed a BDS resolution. And so none of these bills passed. Why did none of them pass? Because they were clearly blatantly unconstitutional, and because there was a very strong organizing effort, including Freedom to Boycott in Maryland coalition, and including a great coalition of activists in New York that came together and fought these bills. So at Palestine Legal and the Center for Constitutional Rights, National Lawyers Guild, we made the legal argument that no, sorry, state lawmakers, you cannot do this. You as politicians don't have the right to threaten funding to suppress speech. That's a violation of basic First Amendment principles. So here's a quote. The New York bill, this is about the New York bill, is an ill-considered response to the American Studies Association resolution and would trample on academic freedoms and would chill speech and dissent. Where's this quote from? Any guesses? Not some left-wing legal organization or association, but our friends at the New York Times. Not exactly the Palestinian freedom fighters, but at least strong on First Amendment and academic freedom issues. So we had good media criticism of these bills. So fast forward from 2014 to 2015, in the span of 1 year, the BDS movement started gaining quite a bit of traction, especially on college campuses, divestment resolution after divestment resolution, and also in religious institutions. And so lawmakers, Israel advocacy groups got together again and said, what can we do? These academic freedom threats didn't work. What can we do now? We can't make BDS illegal because there's this First Amendment problem. So how can we go around that? And so now what we're seeing is the proliferation of anti-BDS legislation that vary from state to state, but they all include three basic components, or at least two of these three components. The first component is a blacklist. So, this is Israel advocacy organizations going to lawmakers and saying, you have to blacklist these people. In some cases, it's people. In some cases, it's organizations. In some cases, it's corporations. So in New York, for example, it's all of the above. Individuals would be blacklisted. Individuals, there's no limit in the geographic scope. So somebody in a village in India who supports BDS, if the bill in New York passes, would be blacklisted by the state of New York. It's crazy. Second component is a prohibition on state contracts. So they say, okay, we can't make boycotting Israel illegal, but what if we say, if you boycott Israel, we're not going to let you do business with the state of New York or whatever state it is. And the third component is pension fund divestment. They're saying, all right, if you are a corporation and you boycott Israel, we don't want to have anything to do with you, so we're going to divest our pension fund from you. So this is lawmakers with Israel advocacy groups trying to be creative in their approach to violating the First Amendment, basically. But there are basic constitutional principles that say, you can't suppress protected speech, and you can't use government, government funding, you can't use government levers as a way to suppress that speech. And there's actually very clear Supreme Court case law from the late 90s that says very directly the government cannot punish state contractors for their political viewpoints. And so these state contracting laws in particular are directly violate that very clear Supreme Court case law. So I tried to fit it all in one slide, but they didn't all fit because there's so many of them. But this is kind of like an example of what's being introduced in the states. You don't need to memorize it all right now because I'll give you a link to a website that has all the information you need. The top five, Illinois, South Carolina, Florida, Indiana, and Arizona, have all passed and become law. Illinois was the first. It happened last year. And their bill, their law, requires the state to create a blacklist of foreign companies that boycott Israel and requires a state pension fund to divest from those companies. And so just about a month ago, the state of Illinois finally released their blacklist of foreign companies. And it's been criticized. Illinois has actually become kind of a laughingstock in the media because on this blacklist appear companies that have said out loud, like, we have not boycotted Israel. We have no intention to do so. It also includes G4S, which is the target of BDS campaigns. And so Illinois has come under a lot of pressure and has been mocked for their blacklist. And it kind of goes to show, I think, how in a way these bills are not only ineffective, but also these things are being created behind closed doors without any transparency, these lists. And in the end, they're actually making a mockery of the state lawmakers who have been advocating for them. New York's, so far, I think, is the most blatantly unconstitutional because, as I mentioned, its blacklist includes individuals. I think that's the only state that includes individuals right now, but that hasn't passed. I think one of the bills passed the state Senate, but it has not passed the Assembly. And Pennsylvania has three different bills pending. One of them is an academic freedom bill, a la 2014. They missed that boat and didn't get the memo. I don't think that bill is going to be moving anywhere, though. So this is a quote about, I'm going to play the who said this again game. This is a quote about the California bill. The bill, AB 2844, in print raises very serious and possibly insurmountable First Amendment concerns. Any guesses on who said that? No, not Scalia. It wasn't LA Times, and it wasn't a legal organization like Palestine Legal or CCR. It was the California Assembly Judiciary Committee Legal Analysis, which was released 2 days ago. The following day, yesterday, the committee members made minor tweaks to the bill and passed it to the committee, despite the possibly insurmountable First Amendment concerns. So this is kind of like what we're dealing with, lawmakers who don't even listen to their own legal analysts, let alone groups like Palestine Legal and CCR. Okay, so this is, I think this is the most important slide. I've said it already, but this is really all you need to know. Your right to boycott and to advocate for BDS is protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. There are all these anti-BDS bills out there, and a lot of people are talking about them, and a lot of people are concerned about them. And I actually think that the biggest threat that they pose is the chilling effect that they have. Because people say there are these anti-BDS bills, they are criminalizing us, they're taking away our right to advocate for BDS and to boycott Israel, and that's not true, don't listen to them. They might have these contracting provisions, they might have these pension fund investment provisions, and yes, they might have a blacklist, which is scary, and we should fight them, and our lawmakers should be held accountable. Our lawmakers should be in the business of protecting our rights and expanding our rights and defending our constitutional rights, not the other way around. But at the end of the day, I think the bottom line is we should keep in mind that none of these bills take away our right to advocate for BDS or to boycott Israel, and that's important. I want to talk a little bit about what Palestine Legal and our partners at CCR and the NLG, National Lawyers Guild, are doing, and the ACLU, are doing to fight these bills. At Palestine Legal, I kind of see our job as threefold. And if any of you disagree or have more advice for us, like I would love to engage in a dialogue about what more we could be doing. But I think our job as a legal organization working on Palestine issues is one to track the bills and to provide resources to track the bills and let people know which bills are where in their state. And so we've teamed up with our partners at the U.S. Campaign and the Israeli Occupation and Jewish Voice for Peace to create a website called righttoboycott.org. And if you go to that website, you'll see this map of the U.S. You can click on the state that has anti-BDS bill. It'll take you to a page that has different resources. It lets you know where the bill is in committee or what the status of it is. It gives you a quick description of the bill and gives you a link to take action to fight the bill if there's an action available. So one, I think our job is to track these bills. Two, I think our job is to provide activists with legal resources to fight these bills, to share with their lawmakers, to let them know that these bills violate our Constitution, and to let them know as lawmakers that their job is to protect our rights, not take them away. For many of these states, we've written legal memos or legal letters for your lawmakers. You can download them on the pages, and you can share them with your lawmaker. And finally, I think, as I hope I did today, I think our job is to let activists know or to inform activists not only what these bills do, but more importantly, what they don't do. As I mentioned, I think the biggest threat that the suppression, the campaign to suppress Palestine advocacy has, not just in terms of anti-BDS legislation, but also what we're seeing across the country, is a chilling effect on our right to speak out. When we feel like we don't have the right, when we're scared to speak out, when our speech is chilled, that hurts the movement, that hurts our dialogue as a democracy, and it is not, it's what's going to maintain the broken status quo on this issue. So it's really important to keep that in mind and to not be intimidated by the to not be misled by the media's messaging on these anti-boycott laws. I think that's all, but I do want to talk about the amazing organizing work that's happening. So we've teamed up. I'd love to hear from the Right to Boycott folks in Maryland or Virginia that are here. But some observations that I want to share that I've made at Palestine Legal about the organizing is that, you know, pension fund divestment, like, yeah, it's bad. We should fight it. State contracting is blatantly unconstitutional, and we should fight it. But I think that what we should really keep in mind as we fight it, and what the coalitions that have emerged across in each states to fight these bills have done really well, is use these bills as an opportunity. Rarely does the mainstream media cover BDS, but they cover legislative initiatives, and these are an opportunity to raise, to tell our neighbors and to tell our lawmakers and to tell our communities, this is not only about our constitutional rights, but this is about BDS, and this is what BDS is. And the coalitions that have emerged in states across the country to fight these bills have done a really good job of seizing that opportunity, of placing op-eds in local papers, of writing letters to the editor to talk about BDS, and using this as the media hook. So that's one. And two, what we're seeing now in places like Maryland, in Ohio, in Pennsylvania, in New York, is that these bills have created networks, have created coalitions that have come together to fight them, and those coalitions outlived the bill. And those coalitions that came together to fight these bills are turning, once the bills are done, and saying, oh, now we know each other, why don't we launch a BDS campaign? So in that way, strategically, I think it's important. You know, the Israel advocacy groups behind these bills have a lot of money and have a lot of power. And how can we use that in our favor? How can we use that strategically to advance the BDS, to advance BDS? I think it's an opportunity. And so that's why I think that
That was Rahul Saxena of Palestine Legal, preceded by Omar Shaker of the Center for Constitutional Rights, speaking in April at an event at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. For a video and the full transcript of this presentation, go to electronicintifada.net or thejerusalemfund.org. And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Borisaj, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, who examines the task of organizing effective opposition to Donald Trump and the GOP agenda. George Lakey, author of Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too, who discusses the Nordic countries' successful economic policies that helped them create a more egalitarian society. And lifelong peace and social justice activist Ted Glick, who talks about why he's launched a water-only fast to pressure President Obama to grant Native American political prisoner Leonard Peltier executive clemency. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a New Year's Day address, North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un pledged to deploy an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of launching a nuclear warhead to hit the mainland of the United States. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump dismissed the nuclear threat, tweeting, "It won't happen." Outside observers now estimate the secretive North Korea state has more than enough nuclear material to build a dozen nuclear warheads and actively develop an advanced missile program. American presidents since Bill Clinton have tried and failed to make a nuclear deal with Pyongyang in exchange for aid. Although an agreement was negotiated in 1994 to assist North Korea to develop nuclear power for the generation of electricity and normalize relationships with the United States, the deal collapsed. Both George W. Bush and Barack Obama tried various strategies to contain North Korea's nuclear program, but failed. After a new round of nuclear tests by Pyongyang last year, the United Nations Security Council, including China, imposed new sanctions against North Korea. Beyond putting more pressure on China, North Korea's main ally, there are few means to pressure Pyongyang to curtail its push for the expansion of its nuclear weapons arsenal. North Korea could quickly become Donald Trump's first and extremely dangerous foreign policy crisis. As hundreds of thousands of people fled from war-torn Syria last year, local officials and communities across eastern Germany mobilized to settle refugees and to integrate them into the workforce. A top priority was to enhance the refugees' work skills and fast-track them into skilled positions in Germany's export economy. On a practical level, it meant full-time work internships for refugees in established small and medium-sized enterprises. According to the Christian Science Monitor, in some aging regions in Germany, there is currently a shortage of interested workers to fill existing apprenticeship training openings. Yet the educational level of most Syrian refugees is lower than prospective German apprentices. So there is a push to allow flexibility in training standards in order to integrate more refugees. "It's a serious commitment," said Stefan Tauber, who helps administer a refugee work program in eastern Germany's Thuringia region. We're talking about giving refugees a real long-term work perspective as qualified workers, not as jobbers who make quick money and disappear. San Quentin inmate Chris Schumacher is eager to join the high-tech economy. He currently makes a good wage in prison by sitting behind a computer screen doing complex calculations for a fast-moving Silicon Valley startup. Schumacher, who's enrolled in the Last Mile Works program, is in jail for killing a drug dealer. He's now looked forward to getting job offers once he's released from prison. Currently, the United States has the highest percentage of its population in prison in the world, with 2.3 million adults behind bars. The massive number of U.S. inmates was fueled by stiff sentences imposed with the failed war on drugs. Two-thirds of former inmates are rearrested within 3 years of their release. Computer coding came to San Quentin Prison, which houses the largest number of death row inmates in the United States, through Chris Redlitz, a Silicon Valley venture capitalist. His goal is to break the cycle of mass incarceration. The program is currently expanding into 5 other California prisons and has drawn interest from several other states, including Washington State, where local community colleges are now offering computer coding classes in 2 state prisons. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
When billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump takes the oath of office on Inauguration Day, January 20th, he'll be taking up residence at the White House as one of the most unpopular presidents in modern U.S. history. In addition to losing the popular vote to Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton by 2.8 million ballots, Trump's Electoral College victory of 306 votes ranks near the bottom, belonging somewhere between the lowest one-fourth and the lowest one-fifth of all Electoral College wins in the history of U.S. presidential elections. A new poll from Quinnipiac University finds that Trump will enter the presidency with a 37% favorable rating versus a majority of 51% of those polled who view the Republican unfavorably. When pollsters asked those surveyed whether they thought Trump's behavior since the election made them feel better or worse about him, 28% said they feel worse, with just 23% saying they feel better. As Inauguration Day approaches, the media and much of the nation will be focused on the U.S. Senate confirmation hearings for Trump's nominees to fill his new administration's cabinet. Major controversies have erupted over nominees' history of racist views, conflicts of interest, climate change denial, support for the privatization of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and public education, as well as multiple Trump appointees who have worked for Goldman Sachs and who advocate for corporate and Wall Street deregulation. Your reporter spoke with Robert Borisage, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Here he examines the task of organizing effective opposition against the Trump GOP agenda and the Democratic Party's urgent need for new leadership and energy.
Well, of course, the confirmation hearings, if Senator McConnell, the leader of Republicans in the Senate, has his way, will come and go in a blink of an eye. And his hope is to drive them through the hearings very quickly without anybody noticing. While Democrats, I think, have to find ways to slow this down and to demand that people have a chance, the Americans have a chance to get a good look at who these nominees are and the conflicts that they bring with them, I think that's going to happen much more quickly than one would like. Then we go into the, right away, the reconciliation bill, the first bill Republicans, first order of business, as Mike Pence puts it, will be the repeal of the Affordable Health Care Act, Obamacare. And here Republicans, I think, begin to unravel because their promise is to repeal and replace the law, but they don't have anything to replace it with. And so they're now saying they're going to repeal it without replacing it and wait 2 years, 4 years to come up with a replacement, which will undoubtedly lead states and insurance companies and hospitals and doctors to begin to unravel the act, and people are going to start getting hurt immediately by this decision. And Democrats have to be stalwarts in opposing that and in pointing out the folly, the utter kind of irresponsible and immoral folly involved in that. But I think the bigger and harder task is to not just oppose the stupidity and the really criminal policies that we're going to face, whether it's tax cuts on the rich or kind of total retreat from addressing climate change or the horrors that could well be visited on people of color and particularly on undocumented workers and Muslims. In addition to opposing this and raising a different voice, it's really important, it seems to me, for Democrats, particularly progressives, to lay out big ideas that offer an alternative. It's important for people to understand it is a choice between truly reactionary and profoundly wrong policies and big ideas that could, you know, provide basic rights for Americans from health care, affordable health care, to affordable college, to full employment, and to, you know, empowering workers to organize and win a fair share of the profits and productivity they're producing. All of those policies are possible, but they have to be argued out even as we oppose what's coming down the pike from Trump and company.
When you look at the Democratic Party in the upcoming leadership contests, two of the main contenders being Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison and Labor Secretary Tom Perez to become the next Democratic National Committee chair, you see the Democrats going in the right direction, both in terms of a strategy of grassroots organizing and also coming up with the vision thing of not only opposing the Trump agenda, but as you said, really putting forth some bold new ideas that the country seems quite ready for, given the popularity of both Bernie Sanders and the fake populism of Donald Trump.
Well, I think that the election's a big choice for Democrats. You know, Keith Ellison is an extraordinary candidate, and he's made an extraordinary sacrifice by saying that he would leave his congressional seat if he's elected to lead the party. And Ellison is remarkable because he has perfected in his own district the kind of grassroots organizing that keeps the party alive between elections and builds its strength and creates volunteers and creates energy so that it is not reliant on very big money and it's not compromised in the way that it has been. And that's the model that he wants to take through the DNC and across the country and build in 50 states. He would be, I think, a consensus choice for the position, except for two things. One is he supported Bernie Sanders in the primaries, and while he worked very hard for Hillary once she won the nomination, he was a forceful advocate for Sanders, and there are a lot of sort of what you would call machine Democrats in the DNC who are resentful about the Sanders challenge and who therefore are skeptical about Keith's candidacy. And then I think President Obama wants to maintain his finger on the party, even though he has basically, it's been disemboweled under his leadership. He was key to getting Perez to put his hat in the ring. Now, Perez is a terrific labor secretary and a remarkable man and leader, but he has literally no political experience and no organizing experience in politics, unlike Ellison. And so he's really a placeholder for people who want the party to be what it has been, which is this mix of very big money on the one hand and identity politics on the other, without a real emphasis on populist economics and on building a grassroots base. And so I think it's a big choice for Democrats when they come down to this election.
That was Robert Borisage, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Find more information on groups organizing opposition to the Trump GOP agenda by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. During the 2016 Democratic presidential primary campaign, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders defied predictions to become a wildly popular candidate with passionate grassroots support who almost beat former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. In the end, Sanders supported Clinton in her unsuccessful bid for the White House. But along the way, the independent Democratic Socialist pressured the former senator and first lady to adopt key policy positions, including support for free public college tuition, advocating for a public health care option, and opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. While he was on the campaign trail, Sanders often talked about his admiration for and the accomplishments of the Scandinavian countries of Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. The Vermont senator contrasted the rising inequality in the U.S. with a different system and values in a nation like Denmark, where he said, quote, "Instead of promoting a system which allows a few to have enormous wealth, they've developed a system which guarantees a strong minimal standard of living to all, including the children, the elderly, and the disabled," unquote. The view among a growing number of Americans that the U.S. economic system is broken is one major reason why Sanders' progressive populism and advocacy of democratic socialist policies gained such passionate support. Your reporter spoke with George Lakey, a Quaker activist and mentor in the practice of nonviolent social change, whose new book is titled Viking Economics: How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. Here, Lakey discusses the Nordic countries' successful economic policies that, if adopted in the U.S., could help Americans build a more egalitarian society. He begins by describing his fascination with Scandinavian economics while studying in Norway in 1959.
In 1959, when I got there, they were still experiencing rationing from the Second World War times. That's how hard the war was when they were occupied by Nazi Germans. And they were still rationing in order to make things work for everybody. But what I noticed was it was making things work for everybody, and they'd already pretty much gotten rid of poverty during that period since Second World War.
Well, George, maybe you can talk about the key economic policies that are really guiding the success of these Scandinavian countries in their effort and accomplishment at building an egalitarian society. And the other part of that, of course, is that this system didn't happen overnight, that there was a hard-fought battle over many years, that there were protests and nonviolent civil disobedience actions and a challenge to power that won the day.
That's right. 100 years ago, they were a mess. That's why so many Norwegians came to this country, and Swedes and Danes. And those countries were hemorrhaging their own population. There was so much poverty and so much misery and you know, real hunger and lack of opportunity. And they had to turn themselves around. And they also had a pretend democracy, which is what I frankly think we have in our country right now. They had a parliament that looked like a democratic thing, and they had elections, free elections, and yet it just turned out that the economic elite always got its way. So what they had to do was to tangle with the economic elite. And one of the things they had going for them was a way superior understanding of economics. The economists who worked with the workers and farmers over in Scandinavia came up with a very different approach. They said what really produces a strong economy for a country is the workers, is the farmers, is the middle-class people who manage the units of production and supervise and design jobs and so on, and do training, job training and education. It's those sorts of people who actually, when they are working at their maximum, we will find an economy that's working at its maximum. And so the way to do that is to value work and really get behind people so that they can work at their most effective. Therefore, free university, free education, free job training, free guidance, counseling for people, because what we don't want in our economy is square pegs in round holes. We want people who are really fitted to find job satisfaction. And that's what makes people innovative. That's what makes people creative and productive.
George, I wanted to ask you about some of the major obstacles that a lot of people discuss and the whys and wherefores of how America could adopt some of the important elements of the Scandinavian economic model. And you often hear obstacles such as, well, Scandinavian nations have a homogeneous society, and here we have a heterogeneous society with a lot of diversity and a lot of racism, unfortunately, a lot of scapegoating. We saw examples of that most recently in the 2016 election campaign there's a lot of class conflict in this country that doesn't seem to play as well in the Scandinavian countries.
Demagogic appeals to scapegoating people thrive when there is actual economic injustice. That is, when people are feeling resentful, when people are experiencing the economy as a scarce place. So, for example, the decision in Nordic economics is to have full employment rather than unemployment. It makes a huge difference. We have a lot of working class people whose jobs haven't just flattened out in terms of, you know, ability to generate more income, but even reduced income over the years. Then you're going to have a lot of frustrated people who are going to want to take it out on somebody. And so that just asks for demagogues to say, well, it must be the immigrants who are underselling your labor, and that's the reason, or it must be something else that's getting in your way. Instead of really pointing to the leadership of the economy and saying, hey, maybe the leadership of the economy isn't really doing a good job. Maybe we could do a better job if we created a democracy here and made the economy work for the common good.
That was George Lakey, author of the book Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. Learn more about Scandinavian economic policies and social model by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Native American activist Leonard Peltier and his supporters believe his last hope of leaving prison alive after 41 years lies with an order of executive clemency from President Barack Obama before he leaves office on January 20th. Peltier, a member of the American Indian Movement, was convicted of murdering two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Lakota Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. No evidence has ever been presented tying him to the crime, and he's always maintained his innocence. Peltier's trial was riddled with legally deceptive maneuvers by the prosecution side, including perjury, intimidation of witnesses, withholding of evidence, and more. An appellate judge who had presided over one of Peltier's appeals in the 1990s stated upon retirement that Peltier had not received a fair trial. And on January 4th, U.S. Attorney James Reynolds, who was involved in the prosecution of Peltier's case, urged President Obama to grant clemency, stating it would be in the best interest of justice in considering the totality of all matters involved. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with lifelong peace and justice activist Ted Glick, who has participated in 17 fasts, one as long as 42 days, including many since 1992, calling for Peltier's release. Glick launched another water-only fast on January 2nd, where he says he'll continue until either President Obama grants clemency or until he leaves office on January 20th. Here Glick talks about his experiences fasting for a cause, the results he's seen from conducting previous fasts, and what he hopes to accomplish with this one.
I have actually fasted for at least 12 days, I think 17 times. Many of them, as a matter of fact, were in the period between 1992 and 2001. In the first year, 1992, which of course was the 500th anniversary of Columbus arriving in the Americas, there was actually a 42-day fast that I was part of.
Fasting is a big sacrifice, and you often don't know what impact it has. So can you say why you do it?
My fasts have usually, the first ones were not ones that I initiated, but I liked the idea. I liked the specifics of the particular idea at the particular time in history that they were proposed. As it's turned out, you know, I'm now more open to doing this. I do think it's one tool that can be used to try to underline the urgency of a particular issue. That's clearly, to me, when you use it, when there's a really urgent issue. And there's no question that right now, it's a very urgent issue for Leonard Peltier and for the people who support him and for indigenous people in general. because if he doesn't get out because of Obama granting him executive clemency, he probably won't survive. He'll probably die in prison. That's, I think, a realistic likelihood if he doesn't get out under Obama. I'm fasting probably above every other reason to urge people who hear about this to do what they can to be contacting the White House and to be getting other people to contact the White House right now in this really critical period to urge Obama to do the right thing.
Ted Glick, it's hard to say what kinds of actions lead to the desired changes, but do you feel any of your fasts have been successful, however you define that?
I think they've been successful. In the very first one that I did in prison, related to Phil and Dan Berrigan, there were changes in the way the federal prison system dealt with prisoners as far as parole. That was a big part of the reason for the fast. And also, Dan Berrigan and Phil Berrigan got out of prison years earlier than they had been told by the parole board that they were going to. They had been both turned down. And the fast that Phil initiated led to them getting out of prison, several years earlier than they would have otherwise, most likely. So that probably is one reason why I've continued to do them, because I have seen success with them. But beyond that, fasting is one tactic that you use when you are working on an issue, part of a movement. There are other tactics, of course, and oftentimes you really don't know whether a demonstration or a petition campaign or letter writing or call-ins. It's hard to make a direct connection between which tactic was most effective. But whatever the tactic is, it's always important to be about building consciousness and knowledge on the part of people who didn't know about the issue, being very much about movement building, getting more people actively involved. And certainly fasting, I think, is very helpful along those lines, because when somebody does a long fast, it kind of makes people stop and think, when they hear about it, well, why are they fasting? Why are they doing this? Why are they putting themselves through this? And it's very helpful that way to get people to think about the issue or to think more about what they're doing on the issue, to encourage people to take stronger action. The very specific issue is in the context of the Standing Rock uprising and the indigenous uprising really happening around the country, the connections that have been made as a result of that Standing Rock struggle. It is very much consistent with that for Obama to grant executive clemency to Leonard Peltier to show that he gets it. There are indigenous leaders of many of the indigenous nations who have called for Leonard Peltier's release. He has been in prison for 41 years. He is 72 years old. He is in very bad health. And there is a great deal of legitimate outrage at the trial where he was convicted. There were all kinds of irregularities. The FBI definitely engaged in lies and intimidation of witnesses and so on. That's documented in many places. So long ago, he should have, at the very least, had a genuinely fair trial, and that never happened. So there's lots of reasons why he should be let out.
That was lifelong peace and justice activist Ted Glick, who began a water-only fast on January 2nd to urge others to contact President Obama to ask that he grant executive clemency to imprisoned Native American activist Leonard Peltier. Find more information on the campaign seeking clemency for Peltier by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
We welcome back to the show Noelle Hanrahan. She is the founder and producer of Prison Radio. She is, of course, well known as an advocate for Mumia Abu-Jamal. There was some very exciting and very positive news yesterday in an extremely important case that has been litigated in Pennsylvania now for, I guess, over a year now. Noelle, tell us what happened and tell us why it matters.
So Mumia Abu-Jamal is a public intellectual. He's incarcerated in prison, spent 30 years on death row, but he's the author of 7 books, and he's a regular essayist, you know, like a NPR essayist. So he's inside.
He was
prison.
An NPR essayist until they threw him off the air.
Right.
Now, well, now he's a prison radio essayist.
I think many NPR stations air him, but it's just not coming down from on high. So he, like many people, had a medical condition. He's in prison for life. He's at SCI Mahanoy in Pennsylvania, and he had hepatitis C, which manifested as a serious medical condition that sent him to the hospital and in renal failure. Now, Mumia is extraordinary because he's so accessible to all of us, but he's also just like everybody else. And having a medical crisis in prison is really problematic because the prisons are not set up to really deliver health care. They're, in fact, denying people health care. So when we realized he was that extraordinarily sick, he fell into a diabetic coma, was rushed to a hospital, was in renal failure, minutes from death, we immediately went to federal court to try and get the Department of Corrections to diagnose his condition. Pretty quickly, after our work to get him into a tertiary medical facility, it was determined that he had hepatitis C and that it was likely to be the reason that he was having these extraordinary hepatic conditions. We had to go to court immediately. They were refusing treatment. Now, what we revealed when we went to court and had a preliminary injunction hearing in federal district court in December of 2015 is that they had a policy. They wanted to keep this policy secret. So when we were in court, they were asking the court to keep their policy about treating inmates with hepatitis C under seal. 17% of the inmates in Pennsylvania have hepatitis C. It's the most infectious disease in the country. 1 out of 7 African-American men have hepatitis C. It's called silent killer. You often don't know you have it for 20 years, but when you do start experiencing symptoms, there are like 6,000 people in Pennsylvania prisons that have chronic conditions, which expose them to liver cancer. It's the disease that causes the most liver transplants.
We're speaking with Noelle Hanrahan. She is the producer and the founder of Prison Radio, an advocate and public spokesperson when he cannot speak for himself, for Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'd like to ask you to go back to something you just said about Mumia, and that was during this first hearing, the Department of Corrections said to the court, don't let the public know what our policy is? Really?
So while I was in the courtroom and they were advocating for this position, I went outside into the hallway and texted the Right to Know office and demanded that the Department of Corrections produce their policy. So the next day in court, the judge says, well, we're going to talk about the seal. And the DOC stood up and said, we've been informed by the Council of the Right to Know office that that's not on the table anymore. Here's the policy. They handed it to our lawyers in court and said, the reason they said this, these words came out of their mouth. We didn't want to give it to you because we didn't want the class of inmates who are filing a class action for care to have it.
Okay, and the policy said, in essence, that we don't give care. So what happened yesterday?
So yesterday, we won a federal preliminary injunction. And you can explain to your listeners how difficult that is. The standards to get the DOC, while a pending case is happening, to actually provide immediate care is very high. So if Federal District Judge Robert Mariani ordered the Department of Corrections to immediately give Mumia Abu-Jamal the antiviral fast-acting cure to hepatitis C. In 2013, there became a cure for this disease. There's a cure. One pill a day for 12 to 24 weeks, and this disease is cured 95%. It's like a public health imperative to get rid of this, like they got rid of polio. So we got a federal judge to order that he get it. So he's going to be seen by a physician within 14 days who's able to prescribe the fast-acting antivirals, and within 7 days after that, he has to be provided with the drugs. The Department of Corrections are the defendants. They will likely appeal, but this decision is written so well. And we've litigated it now. Like, Mumia has been seriously vulnerable. He's been seriously ill. He was in renal failure a year and 6 months ago, right? I mean, we're not talking about somebody who's, like, not sick. So this has been very disturbing for the people that advocate for him, his attorneys, his family. I mean, he has been very vulnerable. And so to get, and the relief is nearly immediate. I mean, this is immediate relief. Like, it goes away. The viral count goes away. You are cured. So we're sad that it took this long, that it took us raising $130,000 to do this lawsuit. It took us going to a federal court to get a preliminary injunction. We were denied that injunction in August on a technicality. The technicality that it was denied on was he didn't sue the right doctor, whereas we didn't know the names of the doctors when the lawsuit was first. They were hiding the names of the care committee, you know, the protocol committee. So there were a lot of things that happened in this case that were pretty outrageous, and there hasn't been the kind of accountability, like proffering false documents, but there is now exposure. And this relief for Mumia Abu-Jamal will not be limited to Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is the first case in federal court that has ordered a Department of Corrections to provide the cure to a vast amount of inmates who are literally in jeopardy of dying.
And does the preliminary injunction actually apply to all of the inmates in the institution in the system?
Preliminary injunctions are required to be written in the most narrow fashion. So it specifically applies to Mumia Abu-Jamal and specifically applies to this fast-acting viral medication. But the way that this decision is written, it excoriates, it destroys the protocol. It says that the protocol that's been promulgated cannot be corrected. Even if they change the language, the footnote of the decision says that when you only treat 1% of the people who are at risk for dying, when there's 6,000 people and you treat 50, when you treat that few, you are creating a condition where they're violating the Eighth Amendment on its face. Nothing in the documents that they're going to provide is going to correct unless, my opinion says, unless they treat it based on what the CDC says, the Center for Disease Control, the American Liver Association. Every single medical association has said that the treatment for chronic hepatitis C is the administration of the cure. If the percentages are, if they do not treat these 6,000 people, we're getting death certificates for people that say hep C. I mean, you know, if they don't treat people, they're going to be in violation.
And this preliminary injunction yesterday is the first, the one that is issued on behalf of Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is the first in the country to make this decision. It should have far-reaching impact on prisons across America and will save lives across America, because prisons are not allowed to kill people who they can treat and who they can save with proper medical attention.
And here, this is what we say. You know, the prison walls are an illusion. Right? Tuberculosis does not stay within the prison, right? So if you don't treat it there, you're going to have it in the public. 99% of the people get out. 1 in 46 people in America will do time in prison. This is a public health imperative. If you're going to wipe out the most infectious disease in America, hepatitis C, that is 100 times more infectious than HIV and has a huge healthcare cost, it's cost effective for any government to treat it. Now, you have a vast amount of people in prison. They're easily treatable. it's like a great place to start, you know? So, I mean, it's all for all of us. It's for all of us.
Let's leave it there. We've been speaking with Noelle Hanrahan. She is the founder and producer of Prison Radio. Thanks so much. Congratulations on the preliminary injunction yesterday. And thank you so much for all the work you do on behalf of not only prisoners, but for all of us.
What are the realities on the ground affecting the people in Syria? Are the people of Aleppo threatened more by the Syrian airstrikes or by the militant opposition factions on the ground? Could mainstream Western media and human rights bodies like Médecins Sans Frontières and Amnesty International be deceiving the world about the human rights situation throughout Syria? Is there a Syrian civil war pitting a popular internal resistance against a brutal despotic government, or is this an invasion in disguise? What are the true aims behind U.S.-NATO efforts to delegitimize President Bashar al-Assad? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we hear an extensive interview with Canadian writer and independent journalist Ava Bartlett about her reporting from Syria and about the media's distortion of the situation there. Then we speak to Stephen Gowans, Ottawa-based author of a new book on the Syrian conflict. He debunks misconceptions about a popular resistance in Syria and about the West's true aims in the region. On this week's program, what's really going on in Syria? Conversations with Ava Bartlett and Stephen Gowans. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. CIA was bluffing, produced no evidence. Russians did not hack the election. Is this the beginning of the end of the deep state in the USA? Can Trump clean house and wage peace? Aided by enormous restraint on the part of Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, the soft coup in the USA has collapsed. Not only has the U.S. intelligence community lost all semblance of credibility with incoming President Donald Trump, but the blackmail by the Central Intelligence Agency of Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham has been revealed by investigative journalist Wayne Madsen. That comes from the article, "The Soft Coup Collapses, CIA Bluffing, Russia Did Not Hack, Blackmail Revealed, What Next?" by Robert David Steele, posted January 9th. With so much power and authority, like those attributed to top intelligence agencies proclaiming that President Putin directed cyber attacks against fair and democratic U.S. election, who would not believe it? That's heavy stuff. You would think that such agencies must have serious sources and made serious analyses to come unanimously to the same results. Russia is guilty. It makes you forget, or at best confused, in the light of their conclusion to the contrary before. So, all the doubters around the globe, reset your thinking. The CIA says so, and they are most likely helped by their pal in crime, Mossad. But that nobody is supposed to know. That comes from the article, "Russian Cyber Attacking, When the Most Flagrant Lie Becomes the Truth," by Peter Koenig, posting January 10th. Trump nominated Steven Mnuchin, a 17-year veteran of Goldman Sachs, to be his Treasury Secretary. Stephen Bannon, another former Goldman Sachs banker, was named by Trump as his chief strategist in the White House. The sitting president of Goldman Sachs, Gary Cohn, has been named by Trump as director of the National Economic Council, which, according to its website, coordinates policymaking for domestic and international economic issues. Last week, in a move that stunned even Wall Street, Trump nominated a Goldman Sachs outside lawyer, Jay Clayton, of Sullivan and Cromwell, to serve as Wall Street's top cop as chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Adding to the slap in the face to Trump's working class supporters, Clayton's wife currently works as a vice president at Goldman Sachs. That comes from the article, "Here's How Goldman Sachs Became the Overlord of the Trump Administration," by Pam Martins and Russ Martins, posted January 10th, originally appearing at Wall Street on Parade. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
Ava Corrine Bartlett is an independent Canadian journalist, writer, and rights activist who has done extensive reporting from Gaza and has documented the Israeli bombing campaigns on that territory while riding in ambulances and reporting from hospitals. She's visited Syria 6 times since April of 2014 and was in Aleppo twice, including during the month of November. She's about to embark on a tour of Canadian cities to share her understanding of the conflict in that country, which wildly contradicts mainstream Western media narratives. Well, being the show this is, we just had to bring her on to enlighten us about her viewpoints. So, Eva Bartlett, thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor. I have a lot of respect for the authors and people who contribute to global research. I will just note, point. I've actually been in Aleppo 4 times, and I only mention that because it is relevant in terms of combating the lies that the media have been saying about Aleppo.
Okay, well, thank you for that clarification. So first off, I just wanted to give you a chance to maybe give us a little bit more detail about your background, help share an understanding of who you are to our audience. I mean, you've stated that there other than 2 international delegations that you participated in Syria, you were financed on your own dime for the others. And you're not making a lot of money with this kind of reporting. So what exactly motivated you in the first place to take on the task of reporting from these war-torn regions?
It's the same kind of drive that drove me to go to occupied Palestine in the first place, because basically my entire adult life until my late 20s, I was completely politically unaware and naive. And then just by happenstance, when I was teaching English in South Korea, I came across online media that was talking about what was happening in Palestine, and I was shocked. And I mean, that's how naive I was. And I think it's good for people to know that, because there's a reason, I believe, that I wasn't informed on many issues, and that is what we're going to be talking about today, and that's the media and what the media allows us to know or to be concerned about. So in around 2007, I first went to occupied Palestine, and this is all, you know, documented, or it's public knowledge. So anyway, I spent about 8 months in the occupied West Bank volunteering and seeing, you know, awful atrocities committed by the Israelis against the Palestinians. And later I sailed to Gaza from Cyprus and spent a collective 3 years there. Documenting not only the Zionist crimes against Palestinians when they commit massacres against Palestinians, but also the daily crimes of, you know, imposing a brutal siege on the people of Gaza, and also firing at farmers and fishers when they just simply try to eke out a living. So when things started in Syria, I had absolutely no knowledge about Syria, no prior ideas, but I was aware of what was happening in Libya, the crimes against the people of Libya and Gaddafi, and what had happened, obviously, to the people of Iraq, all by the same NATO alliance. And so I started paying attention to independent media like Global Research and other sites and started trying to get informed. I was still living in Gaza until about March 2013, and when I did come back to Canada, then I started talking with Syrians in Canada and trying to get their perspective on things. And then, as you mentioned, one of the 2 delegations I joined to go to Syria, the very first time I went to Syria in April 2014, was with an international delegation of concerned rights activists who wanted to go in solidarity, but also to, you know, be in Syria and meet with people and get their perspective on what was happening. So that was the introduction to my continued visits to Syria. And as you mentioned, except for the 2 delegations, I've gone independently. I've gotten the visa on my own, waited extended periods to get that visa, and then, you know, taken a shared taxi from Beirut to Damascus, and then arranged things on my own from within Syria. So I guess that context is important because we'll probably touch on this, but there's been some media campaigns against people like myself, not exclusively against me, but essentially against people who the media is now dubbing fake news, who dare to contradict the corporate narrative on what's happening in Syria. And one of the slander campaigns has been because of all the publications, including mostly non-paid, that I contribute. I also have contributed a total of 8 op-eds to Russia Today. Some people who want to try to discredit what I'm sharing, which is the voices of Syrians I've encountered on these 6 visits, including extensive travel, you know, 2 months this summer and a month in October, November, as well as prior visits, these smear campaigns are trying to discredit the voices that I'm simply trying to transmit to people by calling me a Russian agent simply because I've contributed 8 op-eds to RT. So long answer. basically, you know, it's devastating what's happened to the people of Syria, and our media, aside from the good independent alternative media like Global Research and others, our media has been a shamefully complicit vehicle to transmit war propaganda and confuse people on what's really happening in Syria.
Ava, do you think you could maybe, like, I'm sure you did your research in advance of going down there, but I am curious to know what your impressions of the Syrian people were when you got there. I mean, I imagine for a lot of Canadians, maybe not necessarily the listeners of this program, but, you know, may just have a kind of an idea largely fostered by the media, I suspect, of these Syrians as these poor, underprivileged people, victims of fate, you know, under this dictatorial government, and they're in this Islamic country, and this, us compassionate Canadians have an obligation to allow all those refugees to come to this country and shower our compassion on them and use principled leadership at the UN. Does that depiction coincide with your understanding, having been there?
That made me laugh out loud, because that is a depiction of the corporate media and so-called human rights groups and Western leadership. And when you go to Syria, you find overall a largely educated people, because you have to bear in mind, unlike our system, education is free there, and people obtain high degrees of higher education. You find people, it's a very secular society, so our media paints everything that's happening in Syria as a sectarian war, but you go to Syria, and Syrians, you can find Sunni Muslim women unveiled and beautiful and, you know, in the present, you know, mixing with, you know, it's not sectarian, basically. You find them mixing with Christians, with Shia, with whatever, Alawi, and they define themselves as Syrian, and they're proudly defiant. They, I mean, overwhelmingly, this is not to say everybody supports President Assad, but overwhelmingly they do. And when I say this again, just like people have tried to paint me as a Russian agent, then people will say, well, she's an Assad propagandist. Look, go to Syria and decide for yourself. You can go to these so-called rebel areas and you'll find a different sentiment, but these are by and large the minority. You go to Damascus, Homs, Aleppo, like I have, to various other areas, and you'll find that people support him, some to the degree that they actually love him and wear T-shirts with his image on it, others because they believe him to be a unifying force. But certainly, above all, they don't see him as the issue in Syria. They are, I mean, again, when things started in 2011, I wasn't there, but I have talked with many people who even participated in protests. And they weren't participating against Assad. They were participating for political changes. This is what they've told me. And many of these people that I've met that had participated in protests, they said, from very early on, they realized something was wrong. These weren't protests for political change. These were empty slogans. These were slogans including kill the Alawis and drive Christians into Lebanon. And, you know, people who did participate in this protest, many of them, even at the time, might have had feelings against Assad. I know somebody, a dear friend from Ma'loula, who for no particular reason didn't particularly like Assad. But over the years, he's come to realize that, in fact, President Assad's handling the situation in Syria with incredible, anyway, he's changed his views, and he sees that he supports Assad. And by and large, the sentiment you'll get there is that this is not about Assad. This is about the mercenaries, the terrorists that have invaded our country, that are slaughtering and beheading and mutilating our people and destroying our heritage. Okay. So and the other thing you hit on is, no, it's not Syrians, just like it's not in Palestine. It's not these people saying, please help us, please UN give us aid. In both situations, they're saying, stop the violence against us. That's all they want. They're a very, you know, dignified people, very resourceful people. They don't want NGOs. They don't want these Save Aleppo campaigns. They want, and thankfully, Aleppo is now liberated. But what they wanted all these years is just to stop the terrorists from sending bombs onto them or besieging them. And this is the same in other areas that are still besieged, like Fou and Kafaya. You know, when we talk about the UN, the UN has been a large part in obfuscating the reality in what's happening in Syria. For example, earlier this year, if I may go on, we're in 2017 now. At the beginning of 2016, there was a sudden overnight campaign of Save Madaya, and everybody, all the media were talking about Madaya, and there was Facebook campaigns about Madaya. Nobody at that time, including the UN, was talking about Fou and Kafraya. Fou and Kafraya are two villages in Idlib in western Syria that have been fully besieged since March 2015. And the United Nations, even in March 2015, when the siege came into place by these different so-called rebel factions, including Ahrar al-Sham and al-Nusra, when the siege was fully in place on Fou and Kafraya, United Nations expressed, you know, their usual grave concern, and then basically said nothing about it. And at one point, I looked at the OCHA, the Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the division of UN, and I looked at their tweets just out of curiosity, and I counted the number of times they tweeted anything about Fou and Kafraya, and compared that to Madaya, and the difference was, astounding. So the situation in Madaya was that in October 2015, UN and Red Cross and I think Red Crescent agencies took in food and aid into Madaya. That's October 2015, and ICRC spokesperson said the people of Madaya had enough aid to last for several months. Come January 2016, suddenly everybody was saying Madaya is starving, and all the blame was put on the Syrian government. And at the same time, when, as I mentioned, Fou and Kafraya were severely besieged, nobody was talking about them. So it was clearly a campaign to, again, vilify the Syrian government. And by the way, when RT journalist Murad Gazdiev went into Madaya with an aid shipment, might have been later in January or early February, he talked with the people, and they were saying the rebels or the terrorists have taken the food. There is food, but we don't have access to it. And this is the same situation that played out in Aleppo.
So they'd say you're like basically talking about unbalanced reporting, but to put it mildly. But I mean, I'm wondering, I feel like I have to ask you this just for the sake of some skeptical listeners, but if you could just sort of establish the integrity of your own reporting in the sense, like, okay, when you talk to these people, exactly, like, what are you asking them? And are you being directed by Syrian government officials and they're saying, oh, you can talk to those people over there, but don't talk to those people over there, that kind of thing? I mean, how, you know, can we trust that you're getting a fairly fair appraisal of what the mood is? Maybe you're not. There are the Assad critics that you're just not able to get to, or not.
Well, I mean, to some extent, that's true. In that, I haven't gone to, say, areas occupied by al-Nusra, where the so-called FSA, the Free Syrian Army, are, and other so-called rebels that the West still insists on calling moderates, even though they have committed massacres from the very early, you know, months of 2011. I haven't talked with these so-called rebels. And so in that sense, people could accuse me of bias. But the reason I haven't talked with these so-called rebels is because I don't feel the need to validate them. You know, the majority of them are outsiders and are funded by the very states that are waging and that have premeditated this war in Syria: Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the West, the NATO alliance, Turkey. And so, no, I haven't spoken with those. However, I have met with the Minister of Reconciliation and with internal opposition parties who are not armed and not funded by the West. And other than that, you know, in my meetings with Syrians, by and large, what I try to convey, yes, I've met with political and religious figures in Syria, in the government, but most of the reports I've written have been to take the testimonies of people from areas where they've been suffering. So, for example, I went to Homs many times. I went to Homs in June 2014, about 1 month, if I remember correctly, after the rebels that were in Homs in the old city had been taken out in a deal that saw them transported elsewhere to Syria in order to bring peace to the old city. And I interviewed, and in fact, at that point, I was with a dear friend who was translating for me, but I also speak Arabic. So the point of having a translator was to ensure that I had, you know, 100% accuracy, but I could understand what was being said. And so I was speaking with this family and taking their testimony, what was life like under the so-called rebels. And obviously what they were saying contradicted what, you know, corporate media was saying. And they were saying the same kind of things that people in Madaya, where I have not gone, or people in Aleppo, where I have gone, were saying, and that is, you know, they were being terrorized, and the so-called rebels had taken their food. I also spoke with somebody who knew the Jesuit priest, Father Franz van der Lute, in the old city of Homs, and he gave his account of how this priest was assassinated by one of these rebels. And so, you know, I was with this person that was translating for me, and offhand, I don't remember if there was somebody from the Ministry of Information with me. But even in instances when there has been somebody from the Ministry of Information with me, they haven't hindered my interactions with Syrians. For example, in Aleppo, there was somebody, and she sat in the side of the room, you know, and I was asking questions to, say, the doctors from the Aleppo Medical Association, which our media never deigned to interview, or when I was meeting with people in hospitals, you know. So at times there have been people from the Ministry of Information present, but that hasn't hindered my interactions. And my interactions in Damascus, I go on my own. I meet, you know, I talk with people in the markets or wherever I happen to encounter them. And maybe I'm being watched from a distance, I couldn't say. And it doesn't matter because I have one-on-one interactions with people. And, you know, in certain instances, I've video recorded them, or otherwise I've just written about what they have to say. So, you know, people can take what I write and the recordings that I have with whatever grains of salt they wish. But the point is, the Western media, BBC, CBC, whatever, that goes to Syria, they pointedly don't try to take the testimonies of people who are overtly supportive of the government or who point out the real problem in Syria is this NATO war on Syria. They phrase it differently. They say the terrorists that Erdogan has sent us, for example. And I know this, for example, one of the four times I was in Aleppo was in, I was there twice in November. And the first trip in November, I actually joined a delegation that was organized by an Aleppo member of parliament. And this delegation comprised, I believe it was 13 other media workers, journalists, photographers, including New York Times, LA Times, and an independent woman who's for years been writing propaganda against Syria, but she joined the delegation as well. And that was the only time that that I was in some sort of government-minded delegation. But even then, you know, what we saw, so for example, on November 3rd, there was an onslaught of terrorist bombings, Grad missiles, gas canister and water heater bombs, explosive bullets, et cetera, that in the end killed 18 civilians and wounded over 200. And we happened to be at one of the main hospitals when victims were coming in. So we all saw the same thing, but people reported it in different ways. The New York Times and Barnard reported it, but then she tagged, kind of balanced it out by reporting claims based on the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in the UK and which has no people on the ground. They have unnamed activists on the ground. Anyway, she had to qualify the actual genuine suffering of people of Aleppo by reporting based on the SOHR, which may or may not have had any sort of validity. And she also implied that what happened on November 3rd was random, when in fact, talking with the people, and she was there, she heard the cries of the people saying, this is happening to us every day. So this is an example of even when corporate media has access to these people, they aren't replying truthfully, you know. So and what they try to do is to say, well, independents who go there aren't able to report the whole truth. And that, in my opinion, is not the truth. I've never been hindered by the presence of anybody from the government with me.
We'll return to our conversation with independent journalist Eva Bartlett in a couple of minutes. But first, I wanted to remind our listeners that coming up in a few weeks, CKUW 95.9 FM, the community radio station which hosts the original broadcast of this program, is calling on the financial support of our loyal audiences. On the Global Research News Hour, we delve into tough subjects that other programs and other media won't touch. If you're a regular listener, you probably agree that dissident perspectives such as those from Michelle Chosudovsky, Mahdi Nazemroya, Guy McPherson, Ava Golinger, Corey Morningstar, Dmitry Orlov, Pepe Escobar, Stephen Lendman, Eve Engler, Abayomi Azikiwe, Ellen Brown, and others deserve more exposure than they typically get from mainstream or even a lot of alternative media. That's why I'm asking for your help in supporting CKUW, the radio station which has kept the Global Research NewsHour a presence on the local airwaves and on the Internet through podcasts. Independent media have a critical role in dismantling the mainstream media propaganda narratives which were used to justify the U.S.-NATO military interventions in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and now possibly wider conflicts encompassing Russia, Iran, and China. Indie media is needed to provide necessary critiques of globalization and neoliberal trade agreements that the corporate media ignores. CKUW does not accept paid ads, none whatsoever. We don't depend on corporate advertising and the elite entrenched interests which invariably distort content. We receive funding in part from the University of Winnipeg Student Union. Otherwise, we are 100% dependent on the generosity of listeners like yourself to finance the various fees, new equipment, staff salaries, and other operating costs which make it possible for the unique and informed viewpoints you hear on this program to reach the ears of the public. On behalf of the station, I encourage you to assess how important independent media is to you and donate what you can to this station or to any affiliate station which may bring our program to your radio. Winnipeg listeners are encouraged to listen to CKUW 95.9 FM between February 10th and February 17th. The Global Research News Hour airs February 17th at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. You may also donate online at fundrive.ckuw.ca. Please note that we cannot authorize tax receipts for listeners outside Canada or guarantee incentives for listeners living abroad. Thank you in advance for your support. It is greatly appreciated. Now, please stay tuned for more of our conversation with Ava Bartlett. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Maybe we should talk a little bit more, since Aleppo has been so much in the news lately. And I mean, at the same time that I understand there have been celebrations of the liberation of Aleppo on the ground, and I could think that this is something like Vanessa Beely and others could have reported on. But we've gotten in the Western press is that, oh, you know, save Aleppo, it's a terrible disaster. And I mean, I keep getting this, you know, Amnesty International face on my feed, but given your own experiences, did you feel that you or any of the people around you were concerned about the Russian and Syrian onslaught?
I mean, again, this is another instance where the media is manufacturing stories about Russian bombings. Of course, Russia is present in Syria at the invitation of the Syrian government, in contrast to the illegal presence of the American-led coalition that is supposedly fighting ISIS, but is accidentally dropping supplies to ISIS and allowing them to take over Syrian army positions and the city of Palmyra, as we remember. But, yeah, there have been times close calls in various parts of Syria, not just Aleppo. I've been sniped at twice. And in Aleppo, you know, getting there was dangerous. When I first went in July, the access point was a road called that went through the district of Ramusi. And on either side of the road at points, there, on one side and then either side, there was a sand embankment meant to shield from sniper fire, and also an embankment of barrels and various objects also meant to shield from sniper fire from so-called rebels that were based in Sheikh Saeed just a few hundred meters beyond. So there was that, you know, the risk of being sniped at constantly. And this, I have to point out, was, you know, okay, so I had that risk a couple of times, but this is something that Syrians were enduring, you know, all the time, because this was the only access road into Aleppo. And I just want to pause here and make this point that since the so-called rebels took over pockets of Aleppo in I think it was mid-2012, there have been periods where the 1.5 million people of Greater Aleppo that the corporate media just totally disappeared. They never talked about these people. There were periods when these people were under siege and had, you know, no access to the outside world. And that meant no access to fresh food, vegetables, et cetera. And our media wouldn't talk about this. And, you know, so it would be, for example, this particular road going through Ramusi was cut off by the so-called rebels, and the population of Greater Aleppo was under siege. So make that point. In August, I entered Aleppo by the north along a road called Castello. And this is because, in fact, the Ramosi Road had been closed due to heavy so-called rebel shelling and you know, attacks on Ramosi. And so it was closed. That road was closed because it was too dangerous to travel on. The Castello Road had just been opened because the Syrian army and allies, regional allies, had just liberated that area, the areas around it. And so this is now the only road into Aleppo. And it was also dangerous because rebel or mercenary factions to the, I think it was the west, were shelling the road. So when we were leaving, there was great, like, they were mortaring the road. It was quite possible that we would have been hit. And within Aleppo itself, you know, I mentioned on a daily basis, these militant factions, these mercenaries, these terrorists, you know, invading the country, were shelling the city. And they weren't just shelling military positions. You'd think that's what they'd be doing. But just as in Damascus with the mortars that terrorists fire from Jobar or Ghouta district east of Damascus, in Aleppo also, these mercenaries were targeting parks and hospitals and universities or the University of Aleppo and schools and, you know, streets, public places, public spaces. And so there was always that possibility of getting hit by one of their gas canister bombs, water heater bombs. There was an explosion roughly 500 meters away. I don't know what kind of bomb it was, and I'm not sure the extent of the damage that day in July. And also an explosive bullet landed something 10, 15 meters away. So, you know, actually the day after I left, a good friend's mother was killed by one of these explosive bullets. And when I talked with the Aleppo, what's the name? Not coroner. Head of forensics there, he said that 11,000 civilians had been killed by these bombings over the past 4 or 5 years. So, you know, again, with all these fake crocodile tears for Save Aleppo and these Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch reports and tweets, they actually didn't care about the people of Greater Aleppo. They, you know, I don't remember any condemnation from them or any outrage from the United Nations about what was happening to the people of Aleppo. And I visited hospitals in Aleppo where you can find, you know, children and adults who are maimed, limbs missing, face mutilated by these attacks. You know, so you hit on a good point when you talked about these campaigns from Amnesty or, you know, Amnesty and Human Rights Watch are tied to the U.S. government. And Ken Roth, who is the director of Human Rights Watch, has repeatedly tweeted misinformation on Syria, including tweeting footage from Gaza and saying this is Aleppo and the destruction was from, you know, Assad's barrel bombs or Russian bombing, when it was clearly eastern Gaza, a district I know very well, Shijai. And, you know, he has an agenda, and that is to support the NATO agenda, which is to topple Assad and impose a puppet government in Syria. And yet, you know, these groups, whether Human Rights Watch, Avaz, or so-called anti-war groups like Code Pink.
There's also Médecins Sans Frontières.
Absolutely. They're engaging in war propaganda. Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, was complicit in the lies about a hospital. It was actually an improvised field hospital, to my knowledge, in the Sukari district of eastern Aleppo. And earlier in, I think it was April or so, 2016, MSF came out with a report saying that due to aerial bombings from either Syria or Russian, the hospital was, quote-unquote, reduced to rubble. So, you know, reduced to rubble doesn't mean it was attacked lightly. It means it was completely leveled. And yet, some months later, The Guardian was producing reports saying this particular hospital was treating so-called victims of chemical weapons attacks. And this has been another theme over the years, to allege and accuse the Syrian government of chemical weapons attacks. And every time it's been the so-called rebels. And in this instance, The Guardian was saying, you know, chlorine attacks or something like that. And in fact, that was interesting because the rebels, the terrorists, possessed the only chlorine factory in Aleppo. But anyway, this particular hospital still stands. And there were, at first we had only the imagery, the satellite imagery provided by the Russian Ministry of Defense, which showed what looked to be the hospital in the same physical state as it was in October 2015. So, you know, the accusation of reduced to rubble was clearly false. And more recently, colleagues of mine were in eastern Aleppo, and they went to that specific field hospital, and they were inside it. So it's intact, and it was operational as of, I believe it was July 2016. So, you know, Medicine Sans Frontières doesn't have staff on the ground. They, like the UN, like all the media, are relying on unnamed activists for their information, or they're relying on completely and overtly biased Al-Qaeda-affiliated white helmets, so-called Syrian civil defense.
Effectively, there have been these campaigns against you, and I know that you, to a lot of people, you came under fire after that presentation at the UN. They took a couple of comments that I kind of struck me as being just almost as asides, and like they just jumped on them and used them as to smear everything else that you've documented, photographed, interviews, all of that. We should just ignore it because of a couple of comments in passing that you made.
Yeah.
Would you like to address that in any way?
Absolutely. Thank you. It's interesting that Snopes, Channel 4 UK, which has been one of the heaviest war propagandists in terms of, you know, Western British media, and a few others have written or created these smear campaigns against me. First of all, the articles that they've written don't just address minute aspects of what I said, but they also, you know, tag in things like conspiracy theorist or other things totally meant to discredit my person. And they use strawman arguments wherein they take out of context, or they mix things that I've said to confuse people. So I will admit that I could have phrased things better with regard to the issue of children being used in media manipulation. I still stand by the fact that children are being used in media manipulation, and we shouldn't be surprised because, this has happened in other instances. And even in December, Egypt arrested a group of people who were staging what was to be Aleppo videos, and they had a little girl dressed in white with what looked to be blood but had to be paint. And the Egyptian authorities arrested these people. So, you know, this could have been yet another video produced to say this is Aleppo under Assad or Russian bombing. The thing that I mentioned, a girl who looks to be appearing in a few different situations, I cannot definitively prove that. However, it seems quite possible that she's appeared in at least two different videos, but I can't prove that. I am, however, looking into that, and, you know, I think a forensic video analysis could say whether or not this has been the case. But the point being, the videos that that this girl and the videos being produced are produced by either the White Helmets, who are funded with $100 million from the West, and, as I mentioned, work only in Al-Qaeda areas, and were founded by a British ex-military officer, or they're being produced by the Aleppo Media Center, which is also funded by the West and is not, you know, neutral and impartial. But the other point about that whole conference, so I could have phrased things better, I admit, you know, but I still maintain that there's the possibility, and certainly media manipulation is occurring. One other point I want to make about the White Helmets very quickly. I wasn't aware of this whole mannequin challenge thing, but somebody, one of the White Helmets members, submitted one of their own videos to this mannequin challenge, in which I guess people are supposed to act as if they're mannequins. And it just shows, this video, I don't believe, was crafted to participate in the mannequin challenge video, but it does show that the White Helmets videos are very clearly staged. And in fact, recently, one former White Helmets member came out and admitted that he joined thinking that he was joining what they call civil defense, and at some point he was asked to start acting in some of their productions, and he was saying, why do we need to act? And they said, because we won't get the money from our funders in, you know, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Europe. And he repeated this a couple of times, that he and several others were asking, why do we have to act? And the same answer was that, you know, it's all about getting our money. And he also made a mention of children being in some of these videos, and children were acting. So, I mean, you know, we have to take his testimony also with a grain of salt. Was he being genuine or not in it? But this testimony actually is in a video produced by Anna News, who were on the ground in East Aleppo, and they were at the headquarters of the White Helmets. So it's a quite interesting video. But back to the whole UN thing. So these smear campaign articles focused only on the Aya comment, the girl, and the Quds Hospital. Now, the Quds Hospital, I was only wrong in saying that it hadn't been attacked, because I can't prove that it hasn't been attacked. But what I was correct in general in saying is that, you know, it hasn't been reduced to rubble, and that was the claim of the media, and that was the claim of NSF. Now, these articles did not address any of the other issues that I made, any other points I made in the, say, 25, 30-minute long UN press conference, or the points made by my colleagues on the panel, some of whom have been to Syria. You know, and the points also were about what I've said just in our interview about the life for the 1.5 million plus people in Aleppo, the attacks, and other areas of Syria, which I spoke of. And clearly, the point that they focused on this girl and the Quds Hospital, it was clearly meant just to be defamatory and discredit me. And it may have worked, but it's interesting, if you look at the comments on Channel 4, people aren't buying their propaganda. A lot of the comments are saying, look, we know that you're lying. With Snopes, their article was full of these strawman arguments and also personal attacks, including that conspiracy theorist comment, and completely conflating things. I'm going to be issuing a rebuttal. I'm working on it. I've been quite busy. But I'm going to be issuing a rebuttal kind of looking at both the Snopes and Channel 4 arguments and showing, you know, where their fallacies are. And Snopes itself, I mean, there's some interesting articles out about Snopes and their own compromised, you know, issues and engagements right now. They're said to be a fact-checking site, and yet they, in fact, in an earlier article referencing some of Vanessa Bealey's work on 21st Century Wire with regards to the White Helmets, Snopes completely dismissed the fact that White Helmets operate in Al-Qaeda areas and operate with terrorists and include members of terrorist factions. So Snopes seems to have their own agenda. So, you know, their attack piece on me is itself not credible.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So it seems, there's more to fact-checking than simply, you know, going to one of these sorts of sites. And I would just say to our listeners that, you know, You don't necessarily have to agree with Ava Bartlett, but I think that before you judge her, you should at least check out her reporting. Read the reports that on her site, ingaza.wordpress.com, and judge them on their merits. Please don't dismiss her because she because of a hit piece on Snopes or because she published something on a so-called fake news site called by, you know, certainly the usual suspects. Ava, I think we've got to wrap up now. Is there anything else you'd like to say, either about the tour or you know, anything else we've touched on before we go?
Thanks for mentioning that. Colleagues and, you know, anti-war activists are organizing for me to give some talks in Hamilton on the 24th and 5th, in Ottawa on the 27th, and Montreal on the 28th. And I think that a member of Global Research may be on one of the panels, and also perhaps Stephen Gowans may be on one of the panels. I hope so. I highly, you know, aside from what I've reported, I highly recommend that listeners look at the writings of Stephen Gowans. It's incredibly coherent and articulate and gives a lot of historical context that people need to understand how events have come about in Syria. I'd also really encourage people to look for the writings of Tim Anderson and his book on Syria. Again, he's been in Syria. He's highly articulate and has researched very well. And, you know, with regard to Aleppo, I just say, of course, please look at Syrian reporters, because there are reporters who do report in English. Mohammed Ali reports for Press TV, Ala Ibrahim as well. And there have been other independent people who have gone to Aleppo, particularly during its liberation, Vanessa Bealey, Jan Oberg, Andrew Ashdown. So there's a number of sources. People, what I do, I don't look at one source. Obviously, I cross-reference, and people do not have to believe everything I'm saying. Look at other sources, and you'll find a lot of correlations and corroborations. Thanks very much for having me on and giving this time to talk a little bit about Syria.
Well, thank you very much. We've been joined by Ava Bartlett. She is an independent writer, journalist, and rights activist. Her website is ingaza.wordpress.com. To shed further light on the Syrian crisis, I'm joined by the aforementioned Stephen Gowans. He writes on a number of subjects, is author of the popular blog What's Left, and he is the author of the soon-to-be-released book Washington's Long War on Syria. He joins us from Ottawa. Thank you once again for joining us, Stephen Gowans.
Thank you, Michael.
I'm going to start with a quote from an article written by Ashley Smith of the International Socialist Organization for Counterpunch, which I think encapsulates a lot of the thinking from the anti-imperialist left on Syria. This is the quote. A genuine internationalist left must stand with Syria's popular resistance to Assad, which began as a nonviolent uprising against the dictatorship and against intervention by American and Russian imperialism, as well as by the region's main powers. How could opponents of U.S. imperialism end up supporting a dictator, one who has been known to collaborate with the U.S. in torturing war on terror prisoners in the CIA's extraordinary rendition program? Unquote. So, Stephen, maybe you could start by correcting the record on this popular resistance and its origins, it seems, in Daraa, in 2011. What evidence is there that this revolution from its beginnings was not what people like Ashley Smith are leading us to believe?
I've often heard people talk about this as a popular nonviolent uprising. And I went back to press coverage in the months and weeks immediately following this so-called uprising to look at what was going on, to look at what the New York Times and the Washington Post and Time magazine were saying. And what I discovered was that in the weeks and months preceding that riot, those newspapers and those media organizations were saying, look, there's an uprising throughout the Arab world, but nothing's happening in Syria. Why is nothing happening in Syria? There was a Facebook page that was created at the beginning of 2011 in Syria called the Syrian Revolution, and it called for days of rage demonstrations to be held early in the year. Those demonstrations came off, but barely anyone attended them. They fizzled. And those people who did go to the demonstrations usually chanted slogans that pertained to Gaddafi, who at the time was kind of locked into a war with what we now know were Islamists. The Time reporters and the New York Times reporters started scratching their heads and looking into the reasons why it was that there was little revolutionary distemper in Syria where there seemed to be elsewhere in the Arab world. And what they discovered was that the Syrian government had a considerable amount of popular support. So they said, you know, Assad is very popular, and even his critics concede that. He's endeared himself to the public. He espouses positions that the public support. And there's little chance, according to Syrians, that there's going to be an uprising in Syria. Well, then we did have a series of riots that begin about March 17th in the town of Daraa. And if you look at the reports, March 17th, March 18th, coming from mainline Western newspapers about what was going on, they say U.S. officials have acknowledged that these were violent riots. So there were men seen at the riots who were bearing arms. Buildings were burned down. Governor's office was burned down. The Ba'ath Party headquarters was burned down. Two cell phone company buildings were burnt down. Vehicles were burned. There were clashes with police. These were riots involving a few hundred people. It wasn't a mass uprising of thousands or tens of thousands of people. And it wasn't nonviolent. This is even acknowledged by U.S. officials. The established or correspondent Robert Fisk, who's well known, Robert Fisk also wrote of seeing videos taken at these demonstrations that showed people bearing arms and pistols. So the uprising wasn't popular because it involved only hundreds of people. The demands weren't for Assad to step down. The demands related to the release of political prisoners and an end to wartime measures. And the New York Times and Time soon reported that the riots, there became a series of riots that broke out, and the riots had Islamist content. At no point
can you read in any of these Western media accounts of anyone talking about fundamental changes to the political and economic system?
So I'm wondering if there was a trigger event that made 2011 the time for this to happen. Was it having to do with pipelines? Was it the something that, maybe developments around with regard to Russia? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, some people, or many people, often think that the United States is only interested in ousting the Syrian government and forcing Assad to step down from 2011. But as Patrick Colburn, the Middle East correspondent, has pointed out, the United States has long wanted to get rid of Assad. They wanted to get rid of Assad's father, who was his predecessor as president. In 2001, you may recall that U.S. General Wesley Clark told Democracy Now's Amy Goodman that the Pentagon had drawn up plans to invade seven countries, including Iraq, Libya, and Syria. 2002, Syria was added to the Bush administration's Axis of Evil regime change hit list, and Washington said, Syria was developing weapons of mass destruction in the same way Iraq was supposed to have done, and that it was supporting terrorism. Then in 2005, the U.S. Congressional Research Service reported that the U.S. government was actively weighing regime change in Syria. And they said the impetus for pursuing regime change was to sweep away an impediment to the achievement of U.S. goals in the Middle East related to strengthening Israel, because the Syrian government is an implacable opponent of Israel, consolidating U.S. domination of Iraq, because Syria was opposed to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and also fostering open market and free enterprise economies. If you look at U.S. Documents, say from the Congressional Research Service or from the State Department, you'll see lots of complaints about Syrian economic policy. Syria has often been branded as a socialist country in the United States. Some people would say, well, we don't really believe it's socialist. Marxists might say that. But it's clear that the U.S. government believes that Syria has pursued socialist policies. 2007, the Muslim Brotherhood teamed up with the former Syrian vice president to found something called the National Salvation Front. The National Salvation Front frequently met with the U.S. State Department and the U.S. National Security Council and had two meetings at the White House. They're also receiving funding from the Middle East, or the U.S. government-funded Middle East Partnership Initiative, and it had been reported in the Washington Post that the opposition to the secular Arab nationalist government in Syria had been receiving funding from the United States since at least 2005. So what were the reasons? Why did the United States want to ally with this opposition? I should also mention that in 2005, the Congressional Research Service said that the United States had actually intended to invade Syria immediately following its invasion of Iraq, but it discovered that its hands were full with the occupation of Iraq, its resources were stretched too thin, and that it had to abandon its plans to actually invade Syria and instead pursue this kind of regime change policy in which they would ally with Islamists to overthrow the secular Arab nationalist government. So what's the impetus? The impetus is to do in Syria exactly what was done in Iraq, which is to, quote, de-ba'athify the country, which is essentially remove the secular Arab nationalist influence from Syria, as it was done from Iraq, and to prevent it from ever coming back. If Assad was forced to step down, we should ask the question, why is it that the United States is so interested in having Assad step down? It's not really Assad that they want to step down. Who they want to step down are secular Arab nationalists who pursue policies which are at odds with kind of the Wall Street-friendly economic policies that the United States favors in the world. Also, the United States, I mean, this is quite clear if you read any U.S. strategy documents, that the United States regards itself as the self-appointed leader of a global political and economic order. The secular Arab nationalists in Washington have made it quite clear that they now have no intention of falling in behind Washington as leader of a global economy, that they prize their independence, they prize their economic sovereignty, and they don't intend to, as Assad once put it, make Syrians work for the benefit of U.S. corporations and U.S. banks and investors.
Mm. I want to thank you for enlightening us in this regard, Stephen. And your book is coming out when exactly?
It will be released in April, April 17th, I believe.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stephen Gowans is the author of the soon-to-be-released book Washington's Long War on Syria and of the popular blog What's Left, which can be found at gowans.wordpress.com. He joined us from Ottawa.